And if that, if you would like, if someone from the committee could move House File 489.
I have moved it, Representative Chesky.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Assistant Commissioner Von Mosch is with us today from the Department of Revenue. These two bills, members, are really the governor's proposals for his policy and technical bills for the Department of Revenue. As the chair knows well, we heard these bills and taxes, and there were some data practices provisions that has to be looked at by this committee. So that's why we're here. And if you would permit me, Mr. Chair, if Ms. Von Mosch could simply go over the provisions that are part of this bill that your committee is concerned with.
Thank you, Representative Lachesky. Ms. Von Mosch, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Susan Von Mosch. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Tax Policy with the Department of Revenue. And in House File 489, the provisions that are related to data practices are Article 3, Sections 1, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 12. And they relate to homestead applications, and they basically provide that any tax information supplied to the property tax assessor in support of an application for a property tax classification or benefits would remain private and protected. And this is the type of information that would be on, would be individual income tax information. It might be a Social Security number, that type of information. So that when that is used for a homestead application determination, it would retain the private classification that it has in existing law for the income tax.
Thank you, Ms. Von Mosch. Questions from members of the committee regarding the sections Ms. Von Mosch highlighted? Representative Holbrook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just wondering why you don't think they're already private.
Madam
Ms.
Chair,
Von Mosch.
There are some provisions, for example, for Green Acres. People who qualify for Green Acres have to provide a Section F to the assessor, and some of those provisions are already protected, but there are some for homestead that we feel are not.
Ms. Representative Holbrook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so what do you think is not protected?
Ms. Von Mosch.
Mr. Chair, if with your indulgence, I'd like to call up one of the attorneys with the department to answer that question specifically.
Please do.
Mr. Lance Strika.
Mr. Strika, please introduce yourself for the record.
I'm Lance Strika with the Department of Revenue. I think to cut, Mr. Chair, Representative, I think to cut to the chase here, the concern that I've been told about is if I give tax return information to the Commissioner of Revenue, file my income tax, excuse me, let me, because I always have to stop and back up. The Data Practices Act, as you know, sets out the basic premise for state government data, which is if there isn't something to protect it, it's public. And when I file my income tax with the Commissioner of Revenue, there is a statute that says that's private. The concern I've been told about is if I turn around and take that same return and voluntarily give it to the assessor for some other reason, I've been told that that's not necessarily protected. So we're going out of our way here to double up.
Representative Holbrook.
Mr. Chair, can you point to the statute where the highly protected income tax information loses its classification just because you give it to an assessor instead of the department?
Mr. Strika.
Mr. Chair, Representative Neukamp.
Okay, Representative Holbrook. Okay.
We've seen a proliferation this session of people coming in asking for classifications that I think already have protection.
And I understand that, Representative Holbrook. We are working through some of those issues now. There's been a clear directive from leadership that any data practice provisions come to this committee. I've had several conversations with people that just because you put something in a statute that seems to implicate it, if in the absence of that statute it wouldn't change anything anyway, we don't necessarily need to see it, but it's an educational process to make sure that there are eyes on and people get that. That may be part of the issue. Representative Holbrook.
Mr. Chairman, as I've thought more about the library bill from last week, I'm afraid what will happen is that if we just keep putting this redundant language, because we already have protections for contracts, so the libraries come in and they say, well, we want this extra language, and then we're going to get this, you know, people are going to start coming in for, well, we want our special language, well, we want our special language, and I can see in a matter of time, we're going to have a court case where the courts are going to say, well, you don't have special language in this section, so they must not have really meant it. And so I'm concerned that we're starting down a path that is not good, and that if current law already covers these things, we shouldn't be putting redundancies into various chapters across the statute.
Understood, duly noted, and I agree with you, Representative Holbrook. Other questions for members of the committee for Representative Lucheski? Seeing none, then Chair lays House File 489 over. Chair moves House File 490. Representative Lucheski. Again, members, my intent to hear this bill and lay it over. Representative Lucheski, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 490, we think the reason we're here is to answer questions about Article 3, Section 1, which is notice by electronic means. And so I don't know if Ms. Von Mosch wants to add to that.
Ms. Von Mosch.
Mr. Chair, members, House File 490, Article 3, Section 1, deals with notice by electronic means, and this is an administrative provision that provides that a notice of action can be sent to the last known email address, and that would be sufficient if the taxpayer or another person, typically either the tax preparer or if it's a business, the person who does the finances with the business, if they agree to accept the notice electronically. This is an opt-in provision, and it involves the Department of Revenue's e-services, electronic services, services that we provide to taxpayers, and it is an opt-in provision in that the taxpayer would sign up to receive the notice electronically, and what the department would do is we would actually send the taxpayer a notice telling the taxpayer that there is some document within the e-services program that then they will log into with their username and their ID, and they will retrieve that notice. We have mechanisms within the program that if the electronic notice isn't opened within a certain period of time, we can determine that, and if that happens, we would then send a paper copy to the taxpayer.
Thank you, Ms. Von Mosch. Questions from members of the committee? Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Most of these things, I believe, are time sensitive, and if so, isn't an additional time added on then once that electronic notification isn't opened? Do you get an additional time once that written form is sent?
Ms. Von Mosch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the notice would be sent, I believe, with enough time that, and we would be monitoring the email, that there would be enough time to determine if the notice is not opened. We would then follow up with paper mail with enough time before any deadline would be involved.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Usually that you know, there's enough time for you to action whatever you need to action, and now you're going to shorten that by whether it's a week or 2 weeks. And now, you know, usually it's a 30-day notice, what I'm used to, unless there's a 180-day, whatever it is. But now you've actually eaten up some of that time. I would recommend that we look at that time that we lose there.
Mr. Chair, with your indulgence again, I would ask Ms. Terry Steenblock, who is our Assistant Commissioner for Individual Taxes, to address the committee on this issue.
Ms. Steenblock, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Terry Steenblock, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Individual Taxes for the Department of Revenue. And in today's world, when we send a notice, there actually is a little bit of time that's already built into that notice to allow for paper mailing. So that time frame would also apply with the electronic mailing. And if the taxpayer doesn't open it within whatever time frame, maybe it's within 24 hours or whatever time frame we decide, then the paper notification would be sent. And there is, again, as I mentioned, time that's already built in there to allow for that.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My concern is those of us that travel a lot and go to places that don't always have the email access, and sometimes our mail doesn't follow us and we don't get back for an extended period of time. I just see that we need to build in something. My concern is the email goes out and then and it doesn't get opened, then the mail goes out and I happen to be somewhere else at the time where I'm not getting my mail forwarded to me. I come back and all of a sudden I've got a 24-hour, 48-hour gap to respond to. So that's my concern, and I don't like it when folks just say, well, I'm going to just, we'll look at that and we'll just adjust. I'd like to see that in policy form or something. That's my concern, that somebody's going to get a short notice. Thank you.
Thank you. Russell Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what happens in the case of, say, joint filers? Would both individuals have to agree to electronic notification?
Ms. Steinberg.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the e-services solution that we have in place right now is for business taxpayers. Eventually, we want to get there for individual taxpayers as well. And with individual taxpayers, if one opted in, they would both need to opt in. So if one opted in, the notifications would be sent electronically to that person. If the other one did not, then they would continue to receive paper. That is managed through the system. There's a couple areas within the system, like a Manage My Profile, where they can do it within there. So we typically, whenever we have a joint taxpayer, we make sure that both taxpayers, it's something that both taxpayers want to do. Otherwise, each individual would have that.
Representative Holbert.
And, Mr. Chair, I understand you're going to lay this over, so I would just suggest you probably need more language in here to say that if the email's not open, you'll follow up. I mean, you've just got the very basics in your language. You're not reflecting what you say you're going to do, and I think it's important that if that's what we all agree to, that you show that in the language so that somewhere along the line we don't lose that step and then people wonder what happened. And I mean, if you don't write down that you're following up with hard copy, at some point somebody's just going to decide to stop doing it.
Thank you, Representative Holberg. Any other questions for members of the committee? Seeing none, then, Chair lays House File 490 over. Thank you, Representative Lincheski. And I would note that I'm not sure if you knew this or not, but little donut sprinkles are the way to my heart. So
thank you, Mr.
We grease the skids for you in here.
I did not, but I thank you all and thank you for the hearing.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Holberg.
It's Article 3, Section 3, something this committee should be taking a look at as well, a burden of proof and...
What did I miss? What line are you on, Representative?
I'm sorry, I'm on page 18, section 3.
Oh, that's right. Representative Holberg, this is tax liability and not civil liability, so its jurisdiction lies squarely in the Tax Committee. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you. You're going to get him? Okay, members, we are waiting on Representative Hansen to be here for House File 737. And I do not see Representative Atkins. Are you ready to go? Are you ready to go?
I'm ready.
Okay, we can take up Representative Hortman's bill. Members, I move House File, or Representative Hortman moves House File 446 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce.
Mr. Good morning, Mr. Chair members. I'd like to move that House File 446 be recommended to pass. I'm not sure whether it needs to go. Oh, it needs to go to Commerce after here.
Yes, Representative Portman. Please, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an issue that I was approached about several years ago, that there's a contracting provision that requires folks to sign indemnity clauses, but they can't procure insurance for those indemnity clauses, so they have to kind of promise that they're doing something that it's almost impossible to do. And I have a testifier to more fully explain what the bill does and why we need the legislation.
Thank you. Now please introduce yourself for the committee and proceed.
My name is Eric Heiberg, and I'm an attorney at Healy Duncan and Melander, and I'm here on behalf of the American Council of Engineers Companies of Minnesota. House Bill number 446 really has two things that we're interested in doing. The first thing is it expands the definition of a construction contract under the anti-indemnification statute. And for those of you who don't know, the anti-indemnification statute was passed for construction contracts to prevent some of the unequal bargaining that happens between owners and general contractors and the people down the line. And it sets up the rules for how indemnification agreements, where you're taking on the liability of someone else, can operate in a construction project. What ACEC is interested in are two things. Number one is the current bill defines construction contracts so it only has to do with the design of actual construction, and we at ACEC do more than that. We would like to expand it, and the bill expands it to all engineering and architectural contracts, so it would be studies where there isn't necessarily a building. It would be surveys, other things that don't necessarily have to do with the straight design of the construction. So that's issue number one that this bill seeks to handle. Issue number two is architects and engineers are different than contractors, and they're different in one material way. They have a two-pronged type of insurance. Number one, they have general liability insurance, which covers general negligence. And on the other hand, they have what's called professional liability, which covers their errors and omissions on their professional services. Because of that structure, they simply cannot buy insurance that covers indemnification agreements where the indemnification agreement would cover the negligence of someone else. It just isn't available on the market. So what this bill does is that for this very limited purpose of people governed or of firms and people who are licensed under Article 326, which is the design professional statute, it makes it so that for those contracts you cannot have an indemnification provision if the insurance is not available. And it's a very limited and narrow scope of the indemnification statute to make sure that those types of contracts are deemed unenforceable in court. And so those are the two things we're hoping to accomplish with this statute. It does that. We've worked hard on the language, and we ask that you consider it and pass it.
Questions from members of the committee? Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed in subdivision 2 there on line 1.12, why did we strike the word design? Isn't that what we're talking about here, is the design professionals? Why would we take the design out of the law?
Mr. Heiberg?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, the subdivision 3A is intended to replace the word design, and it introduces an entire new term, which is called a professional services contract. And so in order to avoid the redundancy, we took the word design out of the definition of building and construction contract, because we have created a whole new type of contract called a professional services contract. And the idea was to make sure that they're separate.
Representative Howell. Any other questions from members of the committee?
Mr. Chair, I should note that the
Representative Portman.
Representative Atkins' bill is brought by the subcontracting community. My bill is backed by the general contracting community, sort of in general terms. And the folks are working on making the two bills mesh. They're not to a point right now where they like each other's bills and support each other's bills, but there is, I think, a lot of hope that day is on the horizon.
Excellent.
Representative Holbert?
No question.
Okay, thank you. Then Representative Portman has moved that House File 446 be recommended to pass and to be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you. We have Representative Atkins here now to his bill, which was had a nice segue at the end of Representative Hortman's comments. The chair moves that House File 644 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Commerce. Representative Atkins, to your bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the opportunity to present this this bill to you, and I appreciate Representative Hortman kind of teeing the issue up for us. I don't know that, and in fact, I'm frankly a little bit shocked that this bill is even necessary. If you and I'll read it to you because it's only one sentence long. It says an agreement or contract provision that requires a party to provide insurance coverage to another party or a third party for the negligence or intentional acts or omissions of another party or third party is against public policy and is void and unenforceable. It's a fancy way of saying you can't put your faults on somebody else to insure. I don't know that it can get much more straightforward than this, and I applaud Representative Holberg last year, passed a bill, I think unanimously, on behalf of the truckers that did exactly this. It passed unanimously in the House and unanimously in the Senate to basically say that those who cause harm are responsible for that harm. And what we have is this obscene situation where folks who cause the harm think that they can push it off on somebody else. And that's perverse in our society. That's just not how things work. We hold people accountable. And to do otherwise ends up with perverse results, where those who are responsible for errors or omissions or hurt somebody else can somehow point the finger at somebody else and make them pay for their fault. And that's why I'm happy to carry this bill. I think it will balance the playing field. And the only time that these sorts of things are entered into, by the way, tends to be where you've got one party with a great deal more power that holds something that the other party wants and causes them, if they want to do business with them, they've got to sign something. And that's, as Representative Holberg testified last year, relative to the trucking contracts. You had these big folks making little folks sign stuff that says they were responsible for the big folks' fault. That's just, it's un-American, I think, as long as I'm on a roll here and on my soapbox this morning. But with that, Mr. Chairman, I have somebody on the ground who can testify on the impact of this on a day-to-day basis, but it really is a bill that I feel strongly about. I also want to thank Mr. Johnson, Bob Johnson, on behalf of the Insurance Federation.
What happened when you said the name Bob Johnson?
Apparently, he is in the room. You should have gotten a letter saying that they do not oppose this, and I just wanted to make sure that members were aware of that. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll turn it over to my testifier.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Curtis Smith. I'm an attorney with Moss & Barnett. I am the chapter attorney for the Minnesota Subcontractors Association, which is an association of over 120 subcontractors and affiliated entities. And we are pursuing and proposing this bill. This bill also has the support of at least 18 other subcontractor specialty trade organizations. Basically, it's hard to upstage Representative Atkins here because he hit the nail right on the head. What we're trying to do is actually further a public policy that the state of Minnesota adopted many, many years ago. And 337.02 is what's called the anti-indemnity statute. This statute was enacted many years ago, I don't even remember how long, back in the 80s, in which the legislator declared that the policy of having indemnification agreements whereby one party agreed to indemnify a second party for that other party's own negligence, that other party's own fault, is illegal, void, unenforceable. And that's good public policy for the reasons that Representative Atkins has stated here today. However, at the same time, there was a loophole enacted. It's called the insurance loophole. It's 337.05, which allows a contract to say, we're going to put this illegal indemnity agreement in there, but through this exception, We're going to allow, or we're going to require, allow you to require that subcontractor to buy insurance, naming the general contractor as the named insured on a primary basis, a first basis, for the general contractor's own negligence. In essence, what this statutory scheme sets up is making indemnity agreements illegal and then giving them a back door to have somebody else pay for the insurance for the negligent party. And what we're trying to do away with is that insurance loophole. And that's what this bill is aimed at doing. This is a real issue for subcontractors in the state of Minnesota. The argument's been made that, well, all we're doing is getting the insurance companies to pay, so what's the big deal? This isn't hurting subcontractors. As we all know, insurance isn't free. Subcontractors pay for this insurance. Subcontractors pay for their insurance based on their experience. And their insurance companies will increase their premiums when they have claims. And under the setup that we have today, where that subcontractor has to buy insurance for somebody else who he has no control over, the general contractor, and his insurance company has to respond when there's a claim against that general contractor, even though the subcontractor isn't at fault and is found not to be at fault and isn't even claimed to be at fault, is just wrong, because now that subcontractor's insurance company has to respond because the general contractor is its insured. And at the end of the day, the subcontractor, the party who's not being claimed to have been at fault, has to pay the increased insurance premiums, and sometimes, if it's a big enough claim, may not be able to get insurance at all. This is a question of fairness. This is a question of bringing, having folks be responsible for their own mistakes, their own fault. Subcontractors are not looking for a free ride here. We are willing, ready, willing, and able to pay for our own insurance, to pay for our own mistakes. We don't want to pay for other people's mistakes. That's it in a nutshell.
Questions from members of the committee for Mr. Smith. Representative Holberg.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, have you had the opportunity to review the handout from the Associated General Contractors? And would you care to comment on any of their points, or?
Mr. Smith.
I have, and I would. Thank you. The AGC of Minnesota has issued a white paper that has six different so-called negative ramifications. Let me just address them very briefly, each one of them. The first one, builder's risk, workers' compensation, and additional insurance game changer. They make some very broad statements here. I think the Insurance Federation, who doesn't oppose this, is probably in a better position to tell you, and I know what I've been told, is that, no, this will not affect the insurance. This is talk about who pays for it, and this is an allocation between subcontractors and general contractors. It will not change workers' comp. It doesn't address workers' comp. It doesn't address insurance at all. It addresses construction contracts. I would point out that there's at least six other states that I'm aware of. I'll try to get them all. Texas, California, Colorado, Kansas, New Mexico. That's five. I think there's one more, who have bills exactly like we have, or that we're asking for, I should say. Anti-indemnity laws without insurance loopholes, and the sky has not fallen there. Insurance is still readily available. Negative ramification two is related. Death of OSIPs and CSIPs. These are what are called owner-controlled insurance plans or contractor-controlled insurance plans. They are essentially project policies, policies that are bought to protect a project. And again, my understanding is that I've been told by the insurance people this will not affect that, that these are written on a totally different basis. And again, what I've learned, excuse me, from associations in the other states I just mentioned, it hasn't changed their practice one bit. The third issue that is raised here is ambiguity could mean that insurance policies are illegal. The bill itself, I don't know where you find that in the bill itself. This is not a bill regulating insurance companies or insurance policies. It is simply and clearly related to building and construction contracts. When you go back to 337.01, which is the definitional section for all of these bills, they define a building and construction contract, and they don't define it to include a policy of insurance. Ramification four, a timing problem. There's a timing problem every time the legislature enacts a new law. When they go into effect, people have to address it. This is no different. Construction contracts are being let every day. There never will be a good time if you buy this argument. Number five, restricted freedom of contract. I would suggest that there is no freedom of contract in this area. We have another witness who can testify, a subcontractor, but I've been the attorney for this group for 25 years since its inception, and I can tell you that there is no ability to negotiate certain provisions of a subcontract. This is one of them. Contractors routinely and to a man and woman refuse to negotiate on the indemnity and insurance provisions. And finally, number six, contractors lose risk rights for vicarious liability. That is absolutely not true. Our state law, the comparative fault statute, and common law indemnification rights that we're not addressing here or not changing, have a well accepted way of assessing fault, and we all are responsible for our own percentage of fault, and that's all we're trying to do. Hopefully that answers the question.
Thank you.
Representative Holbrook? Thank you. Representative Scott?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would there ever be a case where a really small subcontractor couldn't get the insurance that they need to do a project, and so that would rule them out of even bidding and having the business?
Mr. Smith?
There certainly are those situations. There can be those situations. This is particularly, it can be a problem for a small contractor who, for example, as I said before, had his insurance have to respond to a claim brought because of the insurance loophole here, where his insurance costs have gotten so high that he or she can't continue on in business or can't effectively get insurance. And if you don't get insurance in this industry, you're not in the game anymore.
Representative Scott?
That's a good thing.
Representative Liebling?
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. I think you might have just answered part of my question, but as somebody who's really, I'm pretty unfamiliar with this area, so my first question was really about what you were talking about the subcontractor having to get insurance to cover somebody else's mistakes. And then you said that the rates can increase on the subcontractor for future purchases of insurance. That I don't really understand why insurers would do it that way. It doesn't make sense, because why increase the rates on the subcontractor when they know that it's the risk, or that the problems are being caused by somebody else? One would think that they would rate based on whose bad acts are really being insured against here. So that doesn't make any sense to me. I don't know if that's really a question or just more of a comment. The real question I'd like answered, and you might have really answered this already, but please make it clear to me if you would, and that is just the person whose project it is. That's the person I'm really concerned about. Is there going to be insurance that's going to cover? I understand this is about distributing the risk between contractors and subcontractors, but the person whose project it is, if we do this, are they going to be covered? Is there going to be insurance that's going to cover whatever negligent acts happen on a project, no matter who caused them?
Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the short answer to your question is yes. Again, a responsible owner will have insurance for his or her project that will cover his or her potential liability in connection with that project. A general contractor should have insurance coverage to cover his or her liability. Subcontractors all the way down the road should have insurance covering their own liability. This is not a situation that creates a gap. We talk about these OSIPs and CSIPs, and I realize we're getting into a little inside baseball on insurance and the construction industry here, and I apologize for that. But that's just a different way of addressing that. You're correct when you say this bill addresses the sharing among and between the parties of who's going to pay those costs. To answer your first question, the insurance company, if I'm a subcontractor, and I'll use Representative Atkins here as my foil, and he's the general contractor.
Everybody else does.
Everybody else does. Why not? and I have an insurance policy. This is an asset of my company. I paid for it. It gives me $5 million of coverage. Now, Representative Atkins has required me to name him as an insured on my policy. So he's on my policy now, so my asset is now a shared asset. He does something negligently, causes damage I don't have any involved in, he can still take my insurance policy, make a claim against my insurance company, and at the end of the day, my insurance company cares about how much money they paid out on an insurance policy. They look at the number on there, they say that's Smith's insurance policy, that goes on Smith's ratings, even though it was Representative Atkins' alleged mistake that caused it, and so I'm the one who's paying the premium, so I'm the one who they increase the premiums on. That's just simplistically the way it works. I hope that answers the question.
Thanks. I don't want to beat this too much, but I understood that that was how it works. It doesn't make total sense to me that it should work that way, because one would think that when the insurance company looks at your next policy that you're trying to buy, they say, well, I don't want you to use, if you're going to have Atkins, work, if you're going to work with him, we're going to give you a higher rate. Go work with somebody else.
I don't like where this is going.
But anyway, but I hear what you're saying.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Atkins and Mr. Smith. First of all, Mr. Smith, thank you for that, the clarity that you brought to that scenario. I just think that really, that example really, you know, helped paint the picture of what really happens. My question is, I'm wondering if this bill would apply to state contracts.
Mr. Smith.
Generally speaking, Chapter 337 applies only to private contracts. The state of Minnesota and the quote-unquote municipalities have a different statutory setup. And I think if you ask the folks from the Attorney General's office, they would agree with me that, in their opinion, this doesn't apply to state contracts.
There's a few.
Apply to the state and its contracting. It does apply, and I guess let me make this, because I don't want to mislead anybody. It does apply to the private relation, the private contractual relationship between a general contractor and a subcontractor who may be working on a state job. It does not apply to the contract between the state, let's use the state as the example, and the general contractor, which is, I know, the position that the Attorney General's office has repeatedly taken on this. I hope that clarifies it and doesn't make it more confusing.
Well, I'm not sure that I'm totally clear. Maybe others on our committee are, and I'm certain they are, but I'm wondering if this will impact state contracts in any way, which it sounds like it may. I'm wondering if a fiscal note has been requested.
Representative Atkins?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pugh, I have not requested a fiscal note and would be surprised if there would be any fiscal impact to the state just for continuing to be responsible for its own level of liability.
Representative
that's what we have insurance for currently, and I don't think we'd go without insurance for any errors or omissions that the state may have.
Thank you, Representative Atkins.
Thank you.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, my experience in the construction field, most contractors, general contractors and subcontractors have habitual relationships. Normally, they work with the same folks all the time. I mean, generally speaking, unless somebody's way out of line in their bid. But how does that work when you do have smaller general contractors and small subcontractors? Isn't there any time where that general contractor's insurance covers those subcontractors, and what happens to that relationship there?
Mr. Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's not so much a matter of size, it's a matter of the contract language. The general contractor should have his or her own insurance. The question is, whose insurance is going to respond first to a claim? In the way we have it set up now and what we're trying to change is, because I've made a getting Representative Atkins back here in the game, I've made him an insured on my policy. I'm the subcontractor in your example. If there's a claim, the general contractor's own insurance policy, because he's got one of his own, but his now is behind mine. Mine responds first. In my example, my $5 million now becomes his first $5 million of coverage regardless of whether I was at fault at all. And his policy now becomes what is called excess or backup. And because most claims are resolved within that first primary layer, except really catastrophic ones, again, I'm paying for his insurance. I'm paying for the attorneys the insurance company hires to defend him. If there's a loss, my insurance company pays for his share of that loss in addition to mine. And mine may be zero, his may be 75, but my insurance company has to pay for his. And that's the problem we are trying to address here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But aren't we talking about that insurance only covers the scope of work under what you're working under, not the general scope of work of the whole general contract? It's only in, if you're the plumber subcontractor, it pertains to your plumbing expertise, not the framer, not, I mean, doesn't that follow suit that every subcontractor has an insurance for his specific area that he's doing the scope of work? Rather than, and then the general contractor has the backup to provide that on the overall, that picks it up after that?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chairman, no. The subcontractor has an insurance policy that covers that subcontractor's business and claims against the business. What this statute as it currently exists does and allows by contract is for the general contractor to say, make me and the primary named insured on your policy, Mr. Subcontractor of Insurance. Subcontractor insurance policies are kind of unlike what you just heard about architects and engineers. They're not written specifically for their scope of work. They're written to cover any potential loss that that business has. And by having this contractual obligation to name the general contractor as a named insured on my policy, I have now brought that general contractor into my policy. So it's not, no, it's not related in just the way. And the problem that we have here is these indemnity clauses are so broad, which our statute has already said is illegal, but you're allowed to backdoor to avoid the effect of the anti-indemnity statute by simply procuring insurance. I hope that's clearer.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it'd be a better approach to limit the scope of these insurance policies rather than indemnify the folks. I think that because the general contractor is still, when the subcontractor screws something up and they're going to miss the deadline, the general contractor is the guy that's going to pay the freight on that deal for missing his deadline. So I can understand why they want to be, you know, covered for that. I would think it'd be a better approach to limit that indemnification or that insurance coverage down to the scope of work of the subcontractor.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've heard that there's a recent court case called ECI versus Bulldog, correct? And I'm just wondering, you know, the findings of that court seem to find in favor of what this bill does. And so I'm wondering if this is another redundancy, like Representative Holberg was saying earlier, we're repeating things in statute. If the court's already found in favor of what this bill is trying to do, is it not already adequate in statute?
Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I'm very familiar with the ECI versus Bolda case. Unfortunately, even though we, as amicus in that case, asked the Minnesota Supreme Court to address this issue on a broad policy basis, it did what the court typically does and really is supposed to do, and it decided the case in front of it on the facts. And while the court did say, as it said many times, that the anti-indemnity statute prohibits these clauses, it then also went and discussed the insurance loophole and exception, an exception that our court has both said is a narrow exception and has said that it's a loophole that has swallowed and eaten up the rule. And unfortunately, the ECI versus Bolduc case did not address the situation we had here, because at the end of the day, the court didn't decide the issue because it determined that the general contractor hadn't properly preserved it for appeal. So it got that part of it got decided on a technical basis. What was decided in that case, which had a potential adverse effect, was that based on some specific insurance policy language in that case, the court determined that the general contractor wasn't covered under this policy, which would have left open the door under 33705 subdivision 2 for the subcontractor who have been sued by the general contractor for not getting the perfect insurance. And so the short answer, a long-winded response to the short answer is no, unfortunately it didn't.
Thank you. Representative Urso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a comment, not a question, but it seems like we're kind of struggling to make sense of what the current situation is, and that it seems like the reason for this bill is that the actual current practice does not make sense, and this is to fix that.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Smith? We have other testifiers. If there are members of the public who wish to be heard on House File 644, please come down and introduce yourself.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Tom Johnson. I'm the owner of Midstate Reclamation and Trucking, and we are predominantly a subcontractor working in multiple states in the upper Midwest. I'm responsible for about 86 house payments, well over 100 car payments, numerous young adults in college, and even more in grade school. Definition of a small business. I want to make sure that we all understand and are clear. This case is about risk transfer. What it is not about is the subcontractors of Minnesota not wanting to take responsibility for our actions or our employees. What we are fighting against is being forced to take on the responsibility for the contractors and owners' actions or work, regardless of whether or not we have proven liability or even involved in the project at the time. I have a story and example in a minute. Actual wording from a commonly used subcontract agreement. It's indemnification, and the beginning of that, the first part of that paragraph is all about our responsibility as a subcontractor, so I won't bore you with that. But it reads, further subcontractor, to the fullest extent permitted by law, agrees to defend, indemnify, and save harmless the contractor, its agents, and employees from all claims, including, without limitation, claims for which the contractor may be or may be claimed to be liable, and the legal fees and disbursements paid or incurred in the defense of those claims, or to enforce the provisions. We are being asked to pay for their actions. If I'm interpreting this correctly, we, the subcontractor, are committing to the contractor, the prime, that we will take on a responsibility to defend and financial for claims that the prime contractor is found to be liable for. Therein lies the problem. We will fully accept responsibility for our actions and those of our employees, but to expect us to take on the liability for the prime's actions is unacceptable. If there is a shared liability, then we will accept that responsibility to be determined and do our share. Our opponents may argue that there is insurance coverage available and we should add that cost to our contract, and so the owner of the project ultimately pays for us to have the insurance coverage. This is not completely true. If our insurance company pays out on a claim, there will be an unknown cost and impact to us, the subcontractor, for years to follow. Insurance premiums have an experience rating discussed earlier, scheduled credits and debts. These are used to reward for little or no claims payments or penalize for high claims of payments made on behalf of the insured. This is the reason the prime contractor wants this indemnify wording. Their insurance premiums will not be negatively impacted. This has been discussed. As a result of the claims and payments, as long as the subcontractor's policies pay for their acts.
Mr. Johnson, if I could ask you to please make the remainder of your testimony brief. We have several more bills up and other testimonies.
Well, that's why I kept on track here. Wrote it down. The story is, we were a subcontractor on a project. We're a milling contractor. We mill asphalt. We were asked to deliver a machine, part of an equation of the prime contractor had traffic control, signage, barricades, the truck hauling, the cleaning, the sweeping, and everything else in the project. We had a machine on a Tuesday. Went in, did the job, we left. On Friday, there was an accident. A year later, we have been notified that we are named in a lawsuit for the actions of somebody else. This happened in 2010. We were notified in 2011. We've been brought into this, and I've had to renew my insurance for 2 years. So I've renewed twice with this claim hanging out here that I have no responsibility in. That's affected my insurance premiums. That gives me a competitive unadvantage because I'm paying for something, and now we are in a low bid system. Your comments earlier, the state and the agencies all use low bid. So I have to raise my low bid to play the game. We have a phenomenal safety record, and this claim is hurting us. Yeah, last thing and comment I'd like to leave with you is, in closing, prime contractors are sometimes and quite often a subcontractor. They will not sign their own contract as a sub. Let's talk fairness. Thank you. I'll take questions.
Thank you. Questions from members of the committee for Mr. Johnson. Representative Holbert.
And Mr. Chair, just for clarification, you said you delivered the equipment on a Tuesday. Were you completely gone by Friday? I mean,
yes.
Nowhere.
We started Tuesday morning. We milled the street.
Mr. Johnson, we'll go through the chair here.
I'm sorry.
Please proceed.
Sorry? Yes. We were in on Tuesday morning. We left Tuesday afternoon. We were in another county, another city.
Representative Holbert. Other questions for Mr. Johnson. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you.
What's that? Tim Power. Mr. Power, please introduce yourself for the record. Please keep your testimony limited to 2 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representatives, my name is Tim Power. I am the Government Affairs Director for the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association. Two of our largest constituent groups are landscape contractors and landscape irrigation contractors, many of whom often serve as subcontractors on construction contracts. We would just like to lend our support to Representative Atkins' bill because it's common sense. As has been stated in the past, we're willing to provide insurance for our piece of the action, but we see no reason to pay for the mistakes of others. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Power. Questions from members of the committee. Tim Werke.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Tim Werke. I represent the Associated General Contractors of Minnesota. We're the state's oldest and largest construction trade association. It's important for this discussion for you to realize we have both prime contractors, general contractors, and subcontractors. So we have a stake in this issue on both sides of it. I want to point out a couple of things. It's in our nature, in our history as an organization, that we work through these things with our partners. We have a record here of working issues out. We have tried to sit down and talk through and discuss these issues. Unfortunately, I think I've been around this process for a long time, and when you hear something is just that simple, that it's just that simple, oftentimes it's not. This is a very, very complex issue involving prime contractors, subs, owners, and insurance companies. To date, we have not had interaction with the owners, the state of Minnesota as an owner, or insurance companies on this issue. And we think that they are significant stakeholders. We are surprised to see that the insurance lobby has weighed in on this issue today. We think that there is a reason why this element in the law exists. It was referred to as a loophole. I would submit to you that it exists for a reason in the construction industry because of the complex nature of construction and the relationship between multiple primes or multiple subs on a contract and how those relationships are handled in the contractual relationship. I was also surprised to learn through testimony that there's a belief that this does not apply to state construction contracts as an owner. The state, if you are not aware, whether it's the Department of Administration, MnDOT, other large contracting entities of the state, is in the business of shedding risk. You will see in any contract between the state and the prime contractor the similar language about risk transfer onto the prime contractor. And as this situation develops, the prime contractor works with the subs through the subcontract agreement There's a reason why that exists. The risk is consolidated with the entity that's closest to doing the work, and then that risk is insured. I would submit to you, if you think about this, the reason the insurance industry would not take a position is if you take that same risk that's now consolidated in that chain and you divide it up between everyone wanting to insure their own risk and their own liability, you get premium, 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 premium. So I just want you to keep an open mind about this. I want everyone on the committee to be aware that we are interested in working through these issues. We have met with Representative Atkins. We hope to continue to have that dialogue. We continue the dialogue with our partners in the Subcontractors Association. That concludes my remarks. I'd like to have my testifier here, Scott Andreessen, address maybe a few of the more complicated issues.
Well, if you could, Mr. Andreessen, we don't have a lot of time to get into the weeds on real complications. If you can be brief with your testimony, please keep it under 2 minutes.
Thank you, Chairman. I will. I'd just like to address a couple of points that were made by Mr. Smith testifying in favor of the bill. And they're relatively straightforward. I simply think that the language that is being proposed in this bill does a lot more than what the Subcontractors Association is seeking to do. By phrasing it the way they phrased it, there are a number of unintended consequences, and Representative Holberg, you referred to the white paper that was put out. There's a lot of deep weeds in this paper, but all I would suggest is the high points are on the first page. And these are the things that impact the most people, and I think they address the questions that have been asked by the representatives here today. The fact is that this bill will dramatically impact insurance. It is all about insurance. It is phrased as an agreement or contract that requires a party to provide insurance for the negligence of another party can't be done. Well, that is what insurance does. A builder's risk policy is the perfect example. Builder's risk is an owner says, I'm going to get one builder's risk policy in the event that the building burns down while we're building it. Now, the owner isn't out there doing any work. The owner couldn't possibly have any responsibility unless they've decided to burn it down themselves, which is unlikely, while it's being built. So that means that either a general contractor, a subcontractor, or someone was out there and maybe they caused a fire. That builder's risk policy is a policy which insures other parties' negligence. And only one builder's risk policy is necessary on any particular project. If this bill were to pass, every contractor on that project will have to get builder's risk policy, because one policy will be illegal because you can't insure the negligence of another under this bill. If that happens, the cost of construction will go up dramatically. The same thing is going to happen. You can't have an additional insured provision. And the second point on this first page is the last point that I'll make, and I think it's one that people ought to pay close attention to. Contrary to what Mr. Smith indicated, this bill would, in fact, make it illegal to have owner and contractor-controlled insurance programs. The very type of insurance program that the state is going to have on the Viking Stadium would be illegal under this provision. Because that is a provision that says you're going to insure everybody under one policy for the liability of each other. And if you can't do that, you're going to have situations where you have disadvantaged business enterprises, minority-owned businesses, women-owned businesses. They're not going to be able to participate in those programs because they simply can't afford the levels of insurance that would be required under this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Doug Speedling.
Mr. Chair, can I ask
Representative Holberg?
Really quick question.
Okay, for which testifier?
Mr. Werke.
Mr. Werke.
Mr.
Go ahead, Rick,
do you see any problems with the way the system's operating right now and what subs have to do in order to get a contract?
Mr. Werke.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg, there are issues and there are circumstances and facts that have led to the stories that you've heard today. And there's no denying that those are real issues. On the other hand, we look at this in some respects as a business-to-business relationship, freedom of contract. If I'm a prime contractor and I have two or three subcontractors saying, yes, I want to work with you, I can get that insurance. And you have one another subcontractor saying, "Boy, that's sure difficult. You're being abusive." Business occurs in the marketplace. Subcontractors are able to do business with prime contractors with this current construct. It may not be perfect. It may not be pretty, but we think that the reason the law is constructed the way it is that there is a uniqueness to construction involving multiple parties, and that this provides a way that economies of scale can come together, that risk can be consolidated and can be insured collectively.
And if I might, Mr. Werke, the previous testimony about the individual who delivered equipment to a job on Tuesday was gone on Tuesday afternoon and got sued for an incident that occurred on Friday. Does that seem fair?
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I don't have the legal background on this, but I, Mr. Andreessen may have a better answer if I could defer to him.
Mr. Andreessen, please be brief.
Very briefly, Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg, as presented, that sounds like the type of thing that would make people like Representative Apkin say that's not fair. But what I would suggest to you is that the contract that Mr. Johnson signed, he only read the second sentence of that contract indemnity provision. The first one ties indemnity to the phrase, it has to arise out of the subcontractor's work. And this is to the point that Representative Howe made earlier. These are not contracts that require indemnity for anything that happens anywhere on the project at any time. Every single contract that I have ever seen, and I represent a host of different contractors at different levels, has said that you have to indemnify us for claims that arise out of your work. So what was being alleged in that case is that loss, and it may not have had any merit, but it was being alleged that claim arose out of the work. Maybe they left some equipment behind, I don't know, maybe Mr. Johnson didn't have a good lawyer. But the fact is that these are not broad indemnity provisions in the sense of you indemnify the plumber for the framing contractor's work. They are all tied to the work of the respective trade contractor. And in that case, there was probably an allegation that the accident was somehow tied to the work that particular milling contractor had done.
Okay. Thank you. Do you have another question, Representative Holberg?
Okay. No, Mr. Chair, it seems like kind of a type of servitude to me.
Strikes me as a butterfly effect, Representative Holberg. Representative Hansen being late to testify caused me to get hit by a car on Sunday afternoon upcoming. Mr. Speedling, Doug Speedling. Not here. Patrick Hines. And would people please shut off their cell phones if they have them on or put them on airplane mode? Please introduce yourself for the record and please be extremely brief.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Patrick Hines. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. We have some concerns with how this bill is drafted from the perspective of the owner. Cities are often owners on construction contracts. To Representative Pugh's question about whether Chapter 337 applied to municipalities, we believe that it does. We have no opinion from the Attorney General saying otherwise. I've consulted with our general counsel, our litigation defense counsel, our insurers and risk managers, none of whom know any basis for why this provision would not apply to cities, so we're operating under the assumption that it does. Cities generally don't contract with subcontractors. We enter into prime contracts with general contractors, and we hire them for their expertise to run a project. And we enter into contracts whereby the general contractor will indemnify the city as the owner, and we believe that is proper because they are managing the project, and that pools all of the risk and the insurance in one spot. If cities are forced to have additional insurance policies, it adds cost and it increases finger pointing, as there is an incentive to try to shift some of the loss or liability onto another insurer, regardless of where the fault lies. So you've asked me to be brief. Those are our concerns. We're happy to try to work with the author to alleviate some of them to the extent possible. Thank you,
Mr. Hines. Okay, are there any other testifiers? Hopefully not. I don't see anyone popping up. So we're going to move on. Questions for the author? What's your name, sir?
Brian Sweeney, BNSF Railway Company.
You're with a train company. How quick can you be, Mr.
Very Sweeney? Very brief, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for showing up, but anyway, we are opposed to this bill, or would ask that some provision be made for the railroad industry. A couple of examples, Target Field would not have been built were it not for indemnification clauses. Part of that structure extends over BNSF track. North Star commuter stations would not have been built but for indemnification clauses. Railroad right-of-way is a dangerous place. Usually general liability insurance policies do not cover any activity within 50 feet of a railroad track. Special insurance provisions are required. We're also not under workers' comp statutes. We're under a tort-based system, the Federal Employers Liability Act. So we have a much more complicated insurance situation than a typical property owner. We have many operations in addition to the ones I've mentioned, that construction projects that take place on our property. If somebody's going to be on our property, which is acknowledged as a dangerous place, of course we want substantial protection in the form of indemnification and insurance. Otherwise, we're having to deal with a risk that would not be there but for this other party's activities on our land. Another example would be hiking and biking trails. In fact, the Federal Highway Administration recommends that states and local authorities indemnify railroads for the hazards related to trail activities. Otherwise, we would not be allowing any trails at all on railroad right-of-way. So for those reasons, we ask that you either defeat this bill or make some provision for the rail industry, as a few other states have done. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Sweeney. Moving on to questions from members. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My comment is for Representative Adkins. You know, we heard Mr. Hines speak to the cost ramifications to cities. We heard Mr. Andreasen speak to the dramatic impact of insurance, of the cost of insurance. I'm wondering if, in fact, again, given this testimony, if there won't be an impact on potentially existing state contracts, and I'm just wondering what the fiscal impact of this might be to the state of Minnesota.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Pugh. My understanding is they already have insurance. I would be shocked if a municipality, for example, didn't already have insurance, but the ability to risk shift and press or pass that risk onto to some contractor for your own willful acts or your own negligence is just plain wrong, and to not have it paid for under your own insurance policy that you've already paid for that's why I don't anticipate any additional costs. They've already got an insurance policy that would pay.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair renews his motion on House File 6. All Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please be heard.
Thank you. Representative Atkins, I just have a question about the. I understand the intention, but I'm wondering about the language of the bill. I represent a company that is in the biotech world, bringing a pharmaceutical drug to market through clinical trials. We manufacture a product from third parties. They provide it to us. We provide that product to hospitals where they do the clinical trial. We usually have to indemnify the hospital against the mistakes of a third party, which is the people who are providing us the drug on a manufacturing basis. We think that is normal, ordinary course of business to indemnify the hospital based on the acts of a third party, which we control. Mm-hmm. Would your bill prohibit that?
Representative
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, my understanding of the bill would be that the answer to that would be no. If you choose to do that, that's one thing. This prevents it from being required as part of the contract.
And it relates to construction contracts. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Atkins, it's only for construction contracts?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, no. This is applies across Minnesota. The extent that people try to risk shift, it would apply to all of those. So if you're trying to have somebody else pay for your willful act and have them insure you for it, that would and require that as part of a contract, you would not be able to do that under this provision. Or a negligent act, for that matter.
Okay. Questions for other members? Seeing none. Then,
Representative Winkler. I made a mistake. It is actually under 337, so it's construction. You're correct.
Okay, thank you. Questions from other members? Seeing none, then, Chair renews his motion that House File 644 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. Thank you,
Chair and members. Appreciate your time.
Representative Hansen.
Here's my question: Why would you treat construction any different than any other industry? That was the question I was going to ask. That I didn't get it out.
Chair moves House File 737 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Committee on Government Operations. There's an author's amendment, A13139. I move the author's amendment to get the bill in the shape the author so desires. Mr. All in Chair. Favor of the amendment, Representative Hansen?
Mr. Chair, we have a two-word incorporation into that amendment on A139. Strike the word "but is not limited to" and insert "may include." I'd like to incorporate that in the author's amendment. This is a result of a compromise with the stakeholders and the agency.
Okay, so all in favor of the oral amendment as stated, line 1.2 on the A13 amendment, strike "but is not limited to" and insert "may include," signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. It is incorporated, the A13, to the A13 amendment. Anything else, Representative Hansen? To get the bill in the shape the office so desires, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. To your bill as amended, Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, this is the Pollution Control Agency bill. When it left the Environment Committee, there was instruction to work on some challenges. The agency and the stakeholders have worked those out over the weekend, resulting in the amendment, and I believe we have the proverbial peace in the valley.
Okay, well then, please proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Kirk Adalka. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I just want to focus on a small portion of the bill that's related to this committee. It's sections 6 through 9 and 11. What this allows the agency to do is carry out environmental covenants as allowed and under 114E for the petroleum remediation program.
Mr. Chair, could you tell
Representative Hortman, I'm sorry, Representative Holbert.
Which article? Article 1 or 2? You said sections 6 through 9 and
Mr.
11
Adelka.
Of...
Mr. Chair and committee members, Article 1. I apologize. Currently, 114E requires explicit authority outside of Chapter 114E to carry out these mechanisms. Other programs within the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, including the Voluntary Investigation and Cleanup Program, VIC, which is very similar to the Petroleum Remediation Program, has this authority, same with Superfund. This allows MPCA to implement an environmental covenant, such as requiring protective measures, do not disturb a cover that's there to protect against contamination underneath, or maintaining a remediation system. This is a non-fee, non-possessory interest in the land. This is not us acquiring the actual land itself, and this is something that we can't impose an environmental covenant without consent. Mr. Chair and committee members, that's the summary of the items in the bill related to this committee.
Thank you. Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have this authority now that you can do this to people's private property?
Mr. Cadell.
Mr. Chair, committee members, not for this program. We do under the VIC program, the Voluntary Investigation and Cleanup Program, and Superfund. 114E.10, paragraph B, requires authority specifically outside 114E to carry this out, and that's what we're asking for in this bill.
Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair, so if we pass this bill, I've heard you use the word voluntary. Is this program voluntary as well?
Mr. Kadalka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, if there is a release of petroleum spill underneath the gas station or home heating fuels, responsible parties do have a duty to clean up the spill under other portions of law. What happens is that some spills are not able to be fully cleaned up. For instance, the product is just on a, we can't get at it, so it's still there. So what we may do is put other protective measures in place so that the company can close out it and have it cleaned up, but prevent exposure. An example is we, for two houses recently that they could not get at the petroleum underneath their house, what we asked them to do is just put on a protective measure, making sure that any future construction was at grade, and then also had a vapor barrier on it to protect against any environmental exposure. That was a much cheaper remedy for the responsible party than the cleanup, and it still protected public health and the environment. So this was an option for the homeowners instead of a more costly cleanup program.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Holbert.
I'll try again. If I vote for this bill, am I taking away property owners' rights?
Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the property owners already have responsibility to clean up the spill. So, no.
Representative Holbert.
So, Mr. Chair, you're not changing any balance of power? Or they still have the same appeal rights? And maybe you could say, what are you changing?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, currently it's allowing us to file those environmental covenants to put in those restrictive measures to ensure the cleanup of a site. That's what we're looking to do at this measure. This is the same thing we do with our other voluntary program, and the voluntary investigation and cleanup program. Again, the responsible party has a responsibility to clean up the plant, the site. This is another option so that they can do protective measures instead of a full cleanup, which may be infeasible or just way too costly.
Representative Holbert.
I was trying to cut to the chase, Mr. Chair.
Understood.
Short time frame. I'm not sure I was successful.
I appreciate that, Representative Holbert. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question. How does this apply to private companies that own oil pipelines or natural gas lines? Will this affect them?
Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, it applies to anyone who has a petroleum spill that would be under their mediation program if they have a spill.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And did you work with the stakeholders in this? Did you work with the petroleum folks and come to consensus at all?
Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we worked over the evening with the weekend with specific service station owners, including the Petroleum Marketers Association. They worked to craft this language along with the local units of governments to address their concerns that were expressed in environment policy. There, as the Representative Hansen mentioned, we have peace in the valley now on the bill.
Thank you. Representative Newberg, you have another question?
I do. Thank you. Page 15, section 15, we're starting in 14 here. Notwithstanding paragraph, no district shall be created within 25 miles of the boundary of any city of the first class without the approval of the governing body thereof. For a point of clarification, would this for this committee, would you please define the for those in the audience and those that are listening, what this first class city would, what that classification is, and then I have a follow up question.
Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a different section dealing with the sanitary district creation. This is something the Office of Administrative Hearings handles with municipal boundary changes, and further in statute, the city of the first class is defined. I can ask the Office of Administrative Hearing. This bill is going to the Government Ops Committee, which has jurisdiction over the local government issues like this, and we'll, it's our intention to have them vet it fully also.
Thank you. Representative Neuberger?
Mr. Chair, I would like the answer to my question. I would like a definition of a first-class city.
Mr. Gehring, why don't you tell the freshman what a first-class city is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Neuberger, there's a definition in statute. It's based on the population of the city. So in Minnesota, cities of the first class are Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth, and Rochester.
It's over 100,000 population at one time, but some are grandfathered in, Representative Neuberger. Representative Holbert?
Mr. Chair, I know you're trying to get this through and we're over time, but I'd also like to have some discussion between now and the floor on page 14, lines 16 through 19, that the Chief Administrative Law Judge may request basically any information and the department will cough it up. And it seems a little broad to me.
Understood. Representative Hansen, between here and the next stop for the committee, would you have a conversation with Representative Holbrook on that section?
Happy to.
Thank you. Seeing no other comments, then was there another amendment on this? Representative Scott?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was mine. I'll withdraw it.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Scott. Representative Paulson Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you could just mark me as abstaining.
Duly noted. Representative Hillstrom abstains.
Chair renews his motion that House File 737 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. Thank you. Thank you. The committee is in recess until 6 o'clock. We will meet in this room again at 6 o'clock. Thank you, members. Okay. Committee's back in order. Representative Dabney, I will move House File 826 that it be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. You have an author's amendment, the A35 amendment, Representative Dabney.
Let me just confirm that if you give me just a moment, Mr. Chair. Yes, Mr. Chair, that is my amendment.
Okay, Representative Dabney, I will move that the move A35 amendment to get the bill in shape the author desires. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you. Representative Dabney, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 826 is the Safe Schools for All bill, and I will try to leave my comments to the aspects that deal with information, because my understanding that is why this bill is before this committee. Safe Schools for All bill replaces the currently weakest anti-bullying statute in the nation with what could be nation-leading efforts on the part of the Minnesota legislature and Minnesota educators to step forward into the next generation of education reform, which is looking at developing and building positive school climates to increase achievement and high school graduation. We provide in state policy a comprehensive definition of bullying, and then require school districts not to take that one unless they so choose, but to develop their own more comprehensive policy within certain parameters. Encourage them to engage in prevention efforts on bullying, collect data on incidents of bullying. Before the Education Policy Committee, I offered an author's amendment that was accepted that significantly tightened the definition of bullying in the legislation, raised the bar on what sort of incidents need to be dealt with, and narrowed the scope of the bill in that respect. But they need to collect data, because in education today, we deal with data. If you ask a teacher or an administrator, how are the kids doing on math in your school? They don't just shrug their shoulders and go, I think pretty good. They give you test scores. They give you data. And they use that data increasingly to define their curriculum and to implement changes down to the individual by individual basis, where they determine what John needs versus what Jay needs to move forward in math or science or English or whatever it might be. So they collect that data on incidents in their own building or district, so that they can see what are the challenges they're having with student behavior, when, where, what type of challenges are they experiencing, so they can respond then to those challenges in an effective way. We then ask them to provide just summary data onto the state, to the school climate center that's envisioned in the bill, so that they can monitor statewide what's going on with bullying. And also we use the data as a form of accountability for schools by placing their bullying data on the school report card, currently existing accountability structure, but adding that information to it. With that, Mr. Chair, I believe that focuses on the data dimensions of House File 826.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Representative Scott.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know that you had said that we're only going to deal with the data issues here, but there are other areas in this bill that fall under the purview of the Civil Law Committee. There are issues regarding parental rights and free speech and constitutional issues, due process. I'm just wondering if we don't address those here, where they will be addressed in the process of this bill.
Well, Representative Scott, we will address them to the extent that they are not addressed in other committees. For example, there are education law issues that are appropriately the jurisdiction of Education Committee. If it is an exclusively civil law matter, I would be open we will consider those here. Right. It's just that there's a lot of jurisdictional overlap.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question pertains to, you've got definitions in here for harassment and prohibitive conduct, and I guess my concern is it looks like we're limiting it to certain classes or certain, based on a person's race, ethnic color, creed, religion, and list all those out. Isn't harassment harassment, and isn't prohibited conduct bad conduct regardless of who it's provided to or who it's conducted to? I guess I'm concerned we're limiting it to a certain section and not saying, you know what, that conduct is not tolerated no matter who you are.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Howe. Actually, your concerns are covered in the bill. For instance, if you look at page 5, lines 7 and 8, at the end of the enumerated list, we specifically say about halfway through after the word however in the comma, prohibited conduct need not be based on any particular characteristic defined in this paragraph or Chapter 363A. So prohibited conduct applies to all students. The Safe Schools for All bill and the use of enumeration in there is the way we assure that all students in the state of Minnesota, have a safe, supportive school environment to allow them to achieve and to increase the high school graduation rate in the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, then why list all those folks? I mean, then why couldn't we just leave it at that? Prohibited conduct need not be based on any particular characteristic, and leave it at that, and then we would make sure that it's all inclusive, because I'm concerned that someone's going to look at that and say, you know what, you're not listed, you know, it's bad conduct, but sorry, it's not bullying.
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, I can't help a principal with poor reading skills, but the statute or the legislation before you specifically includes all students, and most importantly, what research shows us is the lack of enumeration leads to ineffective policy. That the use of enumeration, listing those characteristics of students that research and experience and common sense tells us are more likely to be the targets of bullies, that's how you establish an affirmative responsibility on the part of school administrators, teachers, and other staff to assure that everyone in school is safe. Let me use an analogy. It's the canary in the coal mine. If the school is safe for those who've traditionally been the targets of bullying, the school is safe for everyone. If the school is not safe for one of those groups because we fear and fail to stand up for all of Minnesota students, then it's not safe for anyone.
Well, and I'll beg to differ, because my son was an example in being bullied, but I don't think he'd be protected under any of this, because what he was being bullied about was my service in the military. And so how does that fall into your, how does that, and that's why I'm concerned that as we do what you're saying, list these folks out. How about, I don't know, what political preference his parents are, or what he says and does. How does that, and that's my concern, that when you start listing and someone falls outside the list, these folks that don't fall into the purview of that list, all of a sudden, now are fair game. And that's what happened to my son, and that's why I'm concerned when you start listing and start excluding those folks out, that they be, that they're fair game, and that's my concern, and that's why I would like to see that, you know, if you're going to be all-encompassing, then get rid of the list and be all-encompassing.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney, I would like to move to public testimony soon, so if you can be brief in your response, let's move to public
testimony. I'm sorry, Representative Howe, that your son was bullied, but your son is protected under this proposal. Again, 5.7 and 5.8, prohibited conduct need not be based on any particular characteristic defined in this paragraph. Having a parent in military service is not defined in that paragraph, but your son is covered under that section of the proposal, and it's only when we assure the safety of all students that your son is then protected.
So then thank you, Mr. Chair. Then let's list them. If they get listed, and there's reason to believe that all of these things have happened to include bullying on folks, where did you get these lists? Where did you get the data that says folks have been bullied on all these, and how then did the folks that got bullied under my instances did not get listed?
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howell, the enumerated list is based on research on the incidence of bullying.
Representative Howe, I'd like us to move to public testimony, so this may be better left for the debate at the end of the day. We're going to vote on it. Mr. Pritchard. Mr. Pritchard, please introduce yourself for the record.
Yes. My name is Tom Pritchard, President of the Family Council. We have some concerns with the legislation. First of all, I guess we have some questions as well on the data practices, privacy concerns. Section 2, Subdivision 1, Section 3, Subdivision 4, Section 7, Subdivision 1 all discuss data that's being collected. And I guess we had some questions or concerns about, will names be collected? What data fields will be used? Will parents be told data is collected on their kids? Is there an appeals process if they object to or feel that it's inaccurate, represents their children's situation, where it will be stored? Records, are they going to be kept permanent? Will they be destroyed? We just think there are some concerns there, especially on the part of parents. We also obviously have concerns about the inclusion of private religious schools and private schools. I've got an article I thought I'd hand out. This was the bill is getting some national attention. There was a blog post by UCLA law professor Eugene Volokh, and he raised questions about the constitutionality of not only the implications or the inclusion potentially of private religious schools, even if the notion of public funds are connected, but also even about some of the definitions under the bill. And I don't know if there's a page or somebody could hand that out.
Please hand out the,
But he just raises concerns as well. And we do have concerns about the definition in terms of under bullying. It talks about, gives some examples of, has a detrimental effect on the physical, social, or emotional health of a student. Encourages exclusion, the deliberate exclusion of a student from school, service, activity, or privilege. And, it talks about creates or exacerbates a real or perceived imbalance of power between students. I think those are very vague, unclear terms, and I think it opens the door to implications on free speech and other things which students have. I do want to clarify, we obviously oppose all forms of bullying, but I think we're just concerned that this goes beyond that, and that this is more than just a bullying bill, but it's really, when it talks about creating an environment, it implicates free speech issues, concerns like that, and it's really, in our view, kind of a diversity training requirement for schools. So those are just some of our concerns with the bill.
Questions for Mr. Pritchard? Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Pritchard. Other individuals who from the audience who would like to testify on this, members of the public? Seeing none, then we do have a list of amendments that we will take without objection.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Holbrook.
At what point can we ask questions of the author of the bill?
Well, I thought we would go through amendments and then debate the final form of the bill after that. If you had a question for you wanted to ask them now before we had the amendments, go ahead, Representative Holbrook.
I think we need more information before we decide whether or not we want to offer some of these amendments.
Understood. Go ahead, Representative Holbrook.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dabney, I've got a number of questions, and maybe we should start with the amendment that you already adopted, and I'm not even sure what you're trying to accomplish, but you have, on a federal level, you have FERPA, you also have the Protection of Pupil Rights Amendment, and on the federal law, they don't classify data like we do in at the state level, and so and because of the way it's written, it looks like you're only saying consistent with the laws when they classify data as private, not just state laws classifying data. So do they not have to follow laws if the data is classified as confidential? Do they not have to follow the laws if the data is classified as public or non-public? I'm not sure who drafted this, but I virtually have no clue what you're saying in this language.
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, this bill does not create any loopholes in existing data privacy law. The intent of the amendment was to further clarify that the only data transferred was summary data that did not would not then indicate individuals involved, but was summary or cumulative data.
Okay, well, Mr. Chair, I don't think your amendment came anywhere close to accomplishing that. Representative Simons, chomping.
Representative Simons,
I just want to make sure.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Dabney.
I think the department is trying to get down here and may be able to assist in answering Representative Holberg's questions.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Rose Hermans, an assistant commissioner at the Department of Ed. I have Mary Kay Litzo, who is a legal consultant on this, and she will be able to help you on the FERPA issues.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Regarding for the record, my name is Mary Kay Litzo, Chairman Lesh, members of the committee. Regarding that, I think if we took out the language governing access to private data, I think that might alleviate the concerns raised.
Representative Holberg, does that alleviate your concerns?
Mr. Chair, could she state it again?
Could you please restate that, Ms. Litzo?
Chairman Lesh, Commissioner Holberg, if the amendment was and consistent with state and federal data practices law.
And
Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair, then we get right back to what I've been talking about for a week and a half here. They have to follow the law anyway. I don't know why we're doing this in all these bills. It's redundant. So anyway, it's adopted, it's on your bill, but maybe we can, if I might, have a discussion around the data sets and how they'll be collected. And so you say that going to this clearinghouse, or I forget the name of the governing group, that the districts are going to send in summary data. So will you define for me what data sets will be included in the summary data?
Ms. Litzo?
Commissioner Lesh, Representative Holberg, some of the data that will be included is data that is not always summary that will be included. It would include disciplinary incident reporting data reported by schools, which is actually individual data. There's also the student survey, which would be data that is collected and analyzed by the Department of Health and then sent back to schools and to the Department of Education. That's what we are currently doing. And in additional, there will be summary data relating to bullying incidents that have occurred in the school districts.
And Mr. Chair, well, how will you slice and dice this data? Are you going to ask for how many incidents of cyberbullying versus harassment versus straight-up bullying? Are you going to ask for data on whether it was race-based or sexual orientation-based or special ed service based, or I mean, where are you going with this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Rose Hermanson, I don't think that determination has been made yet, but I do want to assure this committee that we have staff at the department that constantly monitor data privacy issues in our compliance department, and those that staff will be entirely sensitive to the federal and state laws and will assure that we are not violating student privacy information. And we handle some reports now, and the bottom line is, as we proceed with this bill, we will make some determination as to what is appropriate data, what might be useful, and that Climate Center, that will become part of their duties to look and analyze and see what is helpful for us in preventing incidents of bullying in the future. Our whole goal here is to be supportive and deal with intervention and prevention, not to maintain a record in a way that would be damaging in any way to students.
Mr. Chair, I think I heard some testimony saying that some of this might be individual specific disciplining incident data, student survey data, and I just, for members on the federal level, the Protection of Pupil Rights Amendment requires parental consent before you collect information on political affiliations, mental and psychological problems potentially embarrassing to the student and or his family, sexual behavior and attitudes, illegal, antisocial, self-incriminating or demeaning behavior, critical appraisals of other individuals with whom respondents have close family relationships, legally recognized privilege or analogous relationships such as those of lawyers, physicians, and ministers, or income other than that required by law for eligibility for participation in programs. Now, this applies to programs that get money from the Federal Department of Education, so this may or may not at some point get federal grants. But what the point I'm trying to make here, and I'm just getting started, is that because of this is very subjective information, and in many instances is going to be very sensitive. First of all, if you're collecting summary data and you're in a very small school district, there may only be one incident that the whole town knows about. And that school district is, depending on how you do this little report card thing, and what you have there is going to disclose information about students, because there was only one thing going on that everybody knew about, and if you put on your summary data what type of remediation was required or what was done, everybody in town is not only going to know, confirm the rumors are true, but have more information than what I know I as a parent would be comfortable being out there in the public realm. I do not think that this bill should move forward without some pretty tight parameters. As I look at this, there is discretion on whether or not a parent is involved. I think that is just wrong. I don't see anywhere in any of your policies or procedure things that you want implemented any due process. It's all about implementing the policy, Well, what if somebody makes a mistake? I mean, the way I look at this, you could have somebody who is in charge of handing out remediation within 3 days of an incident put some program together that a student has to do without a parent even having any knowledge that this was going on in their student's life. And there may be issues that the student isn't going to disclose that would be helpful to providing an appropriate remediation plan. So I mean, I think there should be required notice to parents, there should be a due process, and these data sets need to be limited because it's so subjective. We are no longer just making decisions about basic behavior, but about reasons for behavior. And in some instances, you may have a home environment that holds a particular value system that it maybe in some ways conflicts with the value system articulated in your behavior policy. And I think that, you know, we're treading on some thin ice here to depending on how this is applied. But the thought that we are going to be collecting very sensitive individual information on our students with no due process really, really concerns me. And I'm not sure what, when you have staff or coaches play a role, with this. In when I look at this, it talks about all this is about student bullying. Is there any, what about staff bullying or teacher bullying? Is that, I mean, why did you exclude them from this process?
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, I don't believe we did. I can't give Representative Holberg a line and page at this instant, but I don't believe we did.
Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair, I circled it somewhere here where, okay. Mr. Chair, let's see. This on page 3, the policy on line 5, written policy to prevent and prohibit student bullying.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, traditionally in education settings, you have separate policies relating to students from those relating to employees. And I think you may be seeing that here. There was confusion in the Education Committee on this point as well at one point. But I think through the evening there, we got people to pull apart that how you deal with employee behavior because of age of majority, because of contracts, because of other laws that apply in terms of employment rights may be different, but you still deal with the behavior.
And Mr. Chair, then if you might point out in your bill where that makes that clear.
Representative Dabney.
We're looking, Mr. Chair. We're looking. Page 3, line 16. Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Hermanson. Page 3, line 16. Apply to all students, school personnel, and volunteers. When I've frequently volunteered in my children's school over the years, and even though I was a licensed teacher at one point, had been a consistent volunteer, was a known entity in the building because of my role as parent and volunteer, one year I showed up and they said, you don't get to volunteer until you have our training, which was a 20-minute video on some of these related issues and privacy issues and supporting the teacher issues and that sort of thing. So volunteers are already included in some districts for this sort of thing.
Representative Holbert.
And Mr. Chair, if you certainly the policy would apply to all individuals in the school, but at the top you lay out what type of policy is, and it's a student bullying policy. So it could be construed that everybody has to comply, and that in the case of personnel and volunteers, they would be mere reporters and not have the same protections because of the modification of using the word student bullying at the top where you define what type of policy it is. So I think you'd be better off if you took student out of that top, because I'm guessing you don't want any kind of bullying going on. And certainly I have... I'm very aware of instances of teachers bullying students, and it's not unheard of, and I would guess that anybody that was on an athletic team and had a particularly aggressive coach might have similar stories.
Mr. Chair, I'd just point out that Section 3 of the bill, which is where 3.16 is, the title is School Policy to Provide Safe and Supportive Schools. It's not limited to students, and it is, as I said, the next generation in education reform is about school climate, and it is, Representative Holberg, about what's the relationship between students, between adults and students, students and adults. That is why the bill contemplates training all school personnel, not just the teachers, because it really does get to what's the climate that from the minute I'm picked up at the bus stop by the bus driver through my school day where I'm interacting with the custodian, the teacher, the lunch lady, in my case, the assistant principal, and then after school to the athletics or extracurricular activity of whatever sort.
And if I might, can you tell me what will happen if, let's say, a remedial plan is put together by the school that is in direct conflict to the value system held by the parents of the student? What happens?
Representative Dabney.
Well, Mr. Chair, the intent of the bill is that schools take preventative measures, first of all, to try to prevent bullying, and then remedial, or I should say restorative measures to support students, keep them in the school community. I don't know, there may be homes that object to having their child told they shouldn't fight, shouldn't bully, shouldn't harass and intimidate their peers or others, but I'm not sure how to answer those folks. Most everybody figures the golden rule kind of is okay.
Well,
Mr. Chair, could you see a situation where somebody may not hold the same beliefs about, let's say, same-sex marriage, and in their particular school or religious community, or they hold a particular value around that behavior, that decision? And I think still in the United States they have a right to do that. And they may express those values or standards that they've been taught in their home around that issue. Someone may take offense to that or disagree with that and view that as a harassment or a bullying kind of behavior, a disagreement of some level. And the remediation that's brought down involves some type of education around that lifestyle choice.
Representative Dabney?
Mr. Chair, first of all, page 9 of the bill at the top, I think it's line 2 or 3. Under relation to existing law that starts at the bottom of page 8, this section does not, jumping over to 9.3 and 9.4, interfere with a person's right to free speech and expression under the First Amendment of the United States. As you know, Representative Holbrook, we couldn't statutorily repeal the First Amendment to the Constitution, even if we tried.
Right, but back to my question, if I as a parent disagree with the remediation that's been handed down on my child as a result of some activity in the school, what's my recourse? Do I pull the kid from school? If I say absolutely not, my child is not going to do that remediation, I am not going to support this decision, I believe the decisions of the school are wrong, I am not going to allow my student to do that. What happens?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, parents disagree with school discipline all the time. And there are avenues, there are policies and procedures in every school district. If you don't like it, you move up the flagpole. Step by step is usually, in broad terms, the outline. And you are able to go all the way, if I remember correctly, to the school board itself to grieve discipline done by administrator or a teacher. So nothing in this bill limits the rights of those parents.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, why did you choose not to have any parental notification or involvement at the front end?
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, actually at the front end we do ask school districts to involve parents in the development of the local policy. Parents, students, teachers and others in the development of the local policy.
And Mr. Chair, I understand that, but in the case of an incident that's going to result in a report with my kid's name on it, probably as a part of their school record, and in some type of summary data form sent to, I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of your group here, the School Climate Center, maybe be able to be shared with other organizations, the Department of Health. I don't know if you got a data sharing agreement, because I know they like the Minnesota survey stuff. You have a bunch of people on this board that are going to have access to that summary data. You don't have any parent involvement or due process up front before a student gets sucked into this whole vortex of this thing.
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, first of all, your scenario that my student's name would get attached on it and then get passed around, all these things. The School Climate Center will never get anything with your student's name on it. They only receive summary data that is not individually identifiable. So let me allay that concern right now. Secondly, nothing in this bill limits students' due process rights. Nothing in this bill limits parental rights. All of the existing state statutes and policies continue as they are.
Representative Holberg.
But, Mr. Chair, if I might, let me give you an example. When my daughter was in school, there was some what I would consider pretty mushy feel-good programs that the counseling department had different kids, a Be a Friend program and different things. And at the beginning of the year, I very strongly and explicitly stated that I wanted my child to be involved in academic activities, and I did not want her involved in any other type of programming within the school day without my knowledge and permission. 3 months into the school year, I found that that statement and that value was not honored, and in fact she was being pulled out of class. And so I don't have a very I'm not very trusting of the schools, let's just put it this way. And I think that you need, when you put in a program like this that is so subjective, I view this as very subjective, you need to have some parental rights up front. There has to be some kind of notification that my kid is part of an investigation as either the victim or the perpetrator in a bullying or harassment situation. I mean, you are going to, in some instances, you are going to have principals or whoever's in charge of the investigation asking about behavior in the home. They may be wanting to look at a cell phone that's owned by a parent, not a student. They may want to look at what's on a laptop that is not owned by that student. And to do all of that with a minor that is not very savvy about their rights with no parental notification, I think is wrong and puts our children in a really bad situation.
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, again, nothing in this legislation limits parental rights that already exist under state law.
And, Mr. Chair, nothing in this bill guarantees parents' rights to know what's going on with their kids relative to application of this policy either. And I think that's very dangerous.
Okay. I have four members on the list, Johnson, Neuberger, Scott, and Yaruso. Members, Representative Holberg did a pretty good job at keeping it, our questions limited to either data practices, things that affected data practices, or those that specifically address civil law. I would note that just because something could potentially be the subject of a lawsuit in court does not make it a civil law matter. But with that, Representative Johnson.
Representative Holberg is in
that. Okay, thank you. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dabney. I just wanted to point of clarification here that has to do with the private property. What we have here on, I'm just going to start with 225 on page 2, where we talk about the policy here. Actually, 223. This section applies to, and it says conduct on school premises. That's obvious. At school functions, these are all obvious. Or at activities on school transportation. Obvious. 227 is where it starts to get blurry, and I would like to get some delineation here. The use of electronic technology and communication on school premises during school functions or activities, on school transportation, and on school computers, networks, forums, and mailing lists. Now it starts to get even a little more blurry for me. I'd like some delineation as I asked. It says, and the use of electronic technology and communications off of school premises to the extent such use is reasonably foreseeable to substantially and materially disrupt student learning or the school environment. Does this mean if two students from the same school are at home at 10 o'clock at night on a Saturday on Facebook on their own PCs or smartphones, would this apply if one is bullying another? As I read how this is laid out, this talks about off-school premises to the extent. Would you clarify that for me? Where does the school stop and the home start?
Mr. Chair, Representative Neuberger, long-time education law focuses on materially disrupting. That's significantly limits the scope of behavior that would fall under the school's authority to that which disrupts the student's learning environment at the school.
Representative Neuberger.
I understand that. I get that. And I thank you for your answer. But it says here in the black and white here, like I said, on 230, it says communications off school premises. So that is kind of a fuzzy definition. And to me, I've got kids in high school and in college. Well, that wouldn't apply to the college students, but the high school students. And they're constantly communicating with each other via electronic means. With each other students. At what point does, like I said, where does the school's reach stop on this? I think that needs to be a little more specific in this bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Neuberger, this is the evolving place of case law already. That schools increasingly are being held responsible for that which disrupts the school day, that which disrupts the educational environment, that which disrupts my ability to access the school environment. Additionally, some of this language was specifically written by the governor's task force on the prevention of school bullying with the reality of the evolving, I'm going to do air quotes here for the record, school. Because now we may have a school that has no bricks and mortar expression at all. That I don't go to a building, I'm at home or at the coffee shop or at the local library or whatever, and I'm doing classes online. That's where does the school start and the local coffee shop end? This is the evolving situation in education. I may be at school for some hours of the day and then leave and take another class online from my own school district. I may be receiving the technology in question from my school district. You know, a one-to-one laptop program, an iPad program, where the laptop that I'm using on Saturday night in your scenario or the iPad I'm using was provided to me by the school district. So it does challenge all of us, I think about where education actually is today as opposed to where it was when I was a kid, maybe you, I'm not sure, and where it's going, which seems to be more and more an online dimension, more and more schools providing technology. So we need to write policies that are inclusive of today's realities.
Representative Neuberger.
I thank you for your answer. I'm going to come away with this. Then the way I'm going to come away with this is that the school really doesn't stop and that this potentially could be a 24/7 kind of thing regardless of where the campus is, whether it's your kid's bedroom or the kitchen table or the school cafeteria or the classroom, correct?
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Neuberger, again, it's not about it. It's about if it materially affects the educational setting. That has been that stems from a United States Supreme Court in the decision of the early 1970s, I believe it was, early to mid 70s, Tinker versus Des Moines. I'm not a lawyer, so I'm on thin ice here. But that concept of materially disrupting the school day is a standard in education that has been in place, teachers and administrators trained to for decades now. Nothing new there.
One other point of clarification. Thank you, Mr. Representative Davini. Page 6, I wanted to point this out to you to try to avoid future problems. I have my wife to thank for this. If you start in 6.5, I'm just going to kind of pick up here the target of the prohibited conduct at the school administrator's direction, notifying the parent of the reported target of the prohibited conduct, the parent of the actor engaged in prohibited conduct. You use this. I do appreciate that that's in there. However, this my wife works as a school admissions person and a health officer. There are lots of kids in her school who have parents that are separated that don't have custody or have restraining orders or have no contact orders or very very strict contact rules put forth by the courts. This language where you have notifying the parent, I think this needs to be clarified to make sure that that this, you're not putting the school in a position where the statute's telling them to contact the parent and now they're also under legal orders not to contact parents. I understand the intent of this language here, but unless this is delineated, you're going to create a headache bar none.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Davini.
Representative Neuberger, I want to thank you for those comments. You'll notice on page 6, line 5, at the school administrator's discretion, not direction, discretion. So if I'm the administrator and I've got a formal notice of a do not contact order, I can exercise my discretion and I'm not mandated because of the flexibility in this law, in this proposal, to violate that. So that language on 6.5 goes specifically to your concern and I think fleshes out even more so why that language is there. Thank you for that.
Representative, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few questions here. Number one, you made a comment that the next generation in school policy is school climate, and I'm wondering who says you say that, but you made it sound like it was a universal thought that this was the next generation in school policy was the school climate. Can you elaborate on, is that just your opinion or is that the opinion of more people that I don't know about? Because this is the first I've heard of it.
Representative Davini, please respond, keeping in mind that this issue will be fleshed out more thoroughly in the Education Committee.
It's already been to Education, Mr. Chair.
Got to go to Education Finance, Representative Scott.
Representative Scott and members, Mr. Chair, Education Week is probably the most important weekly on education finance, education policy issues and the like. This is their quality counts issue of January 10th of this year. Code of conduct, safety, discipline, and school climate.
Okay.
And there are articles in here that go to, let's look at the Minnesota experience. We've established academic standards. We've established a whole raft of high-stakes tests. We've increased the requirements to become a teacher. We're moving pretty quickly here towards increased teacher evaluation, more use of student performance data. We've done all of these things to try to strengthen educational achievement. And bluntly, we haven't moved the needle very much. That's why folks are looking at issues around school climate as the next generation of school reform. Because if I'm not feeling safe in school, I either may not show up, may be distracted, may not pay attention, may be excluded from activities that would enrich or extend my learning. I'm not learning, and I may not then end up graduating from high school in the end. That doesn't help anybody.
Representative Scott.
So that's, I guess, a discussion for another day.
as far as if that's really the real reason that kids aren't performing in school. I'd rather, much rather have a climate of let's have academic excellence above everything else. That's the climate I'd like to see in all schools. What I think is happening with this bill here is I think you're going to run into a whole host of free speech problems, because it's going to come down to whose free speech are you going to protect. In the example that Representative Holberg gave of one student objecting to another person's sexual orientation or their view on same-sex marriage, whose free speech are you going to protect in that case? Are you going to protect the free speech of the person that thinks gay marriage is okay, or are you going to protect the free speech of the person that thinks free speech or that same-sex marriage is not okay? Whose free speech are you going to protect? And I think, you know, what Mr. Pritchard handed out, and I'm glad he did. I hadn't seen this before tonight, but he states that this blogger who was a law school instructor states that there's a whole host of free speech issues here, and he cites a couple of court cases that I think would really behoove you to look into, because the last thing we want to do is set something up like this and then have one lawsuit after another occur. At least I hope that's not what your intent is here, that if you want to do this, that you would want to make it the best that it can be and not have everything landing in court.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, the good news is in the United States you don't have to choose between free speech. We're all guaranteed it, and we reinforce it in the bill. And I think, as Representative Holberg expressed, you know, kind of redundancy, but we do it as for comfort for people. In education, the issues are not the content of the speech. Just to remind you, I was a social studies teacher for 17 years. We dealt with controversial issues, including ones related to sexuality, but war and peace, public funds. I don't think I dealt with sports stadiums, but, you know, a variety of controversial issues in the classroom. A conversation about same-sex marriage. Schools across the state were invited 18 months ago, almost 2 years ago now, to have that conversation with students. Overwhelmingly, I've not heard of any reports of incidents related to those conversations. The issue in education is not the content, it's time, place, and manner. Let me give you an example to go to your point. A classroom discussion on same-sex marriage and should it be legalized or not. I object and I say that my faith says that that's wrong, and you say you're supportive of it and that your faith supports same-sex marriage. That's not an incident of bullying. If I grab you by the lapels in the hallway, slam you up against the locker, get 2 inches from your face, and scream at you that my faith tells me that same-sex marriage is wrong, that's not about the content. That's about time, place, and manner. And I don't think any of us would defend that student assaulting another student.
Mr. Chair, no, absolutely I wouldn't. What about a student that wears a shirt with the round circle with the slash through that says gay marriage with the circle and the slash through it? Is that considered bullying?
Representative Dabney.
I don't believe so. Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, I don't believe so, no.
Okay.
Representative Scott.
Let me find my next question here. I wanted to turn just a corner here and talk about the fact that you are applying this bill and law, if it becomes law, to non-public schools. And I'd like to know why you think that's okay and where you get the constitutional authority to do so.
Well, Representative Dabney and Representative Scott, how is this in the jurisdiction of the Civil Law Committee, of application of this to public schools?
Where else are we going to talk about this particular part of the bill?
Representative Scott, Education Committee.
This is the Civil Law Committee. Do we not handle freedom of religion committee?
Representative Scott, I mean, when you're talking about, I've given latitude already for some of this, but please be mindful that
That would be thoroughly addressed in education. So to the extent there's overlapping jurisdiction, I don't want to duplicate it. Go ahead with it for now.
Well, if you could answer the question.
Representative Dabney.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, the state has a compelling, the state can only limit or can only impinge on private schools in a couple of settings. When we have a compelling state interest. The safety of students is a compelling state interest. Secondly, we limit the application to private schools to only those private schools who accept public dollars. I would imagine bipartisanly we agree that with public dollars should come public accountability.
Representative Scott.
Well, actually, according to Section 123B.40, said is this is under aid to non-public school students declaration of policy. It is the intent of the legislature to provide for distribution of educational aids such as textbooks, standardized tests, and pupil support services so that every school pupil in the state shall share equitably in education benefits and therefore further assure all Minnesota pupils and their parents freedom of choice in education. Now, how do I have freedom of choice in education if on lines... let me find it here. 8.30-33, it talks about the commissioner must post to the department's website information indicating that the school district and school now would allow non-curriculum related student groups access to school facilities. So let's say you have a Christian school and there's a student there that wants to set up a GLBT organization within that school, but it's diametrically opposed to their the Christian beliefs of that school. What then?
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, again, this is current case law. This is, I believe, United States Supreme Court decision. If a school allows a non-curriculum related student group access to the school, access to the PA system, able to post posters, things like that, they have to accept all of the non-curriculum related students groups equally. They don't get to pick and choose. They don't get to say you can have the Gay Straight Alliance, but you can't have the Bible study group. If you have the GSA, the Gay Straight Alliance, then you have to allow the Bible study group as well. So this protects freedom of speech and protects religious liberty.
Representative Scott.
But you're in a private school that this, I would like to see the case law that you're talking about that says a private school has to do that. That applies to public schools. I can't imagine there's case law that says a public school or a private school that's you know, a Christian school or Catholic school, any kind of a religious school, has to allow a GLBT or whatever objectional, something that is diametrically opposed to the faith that they're teaching and that school stands for. I want to see the case law that says that they have to allow that.
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, we'll look into it, but again, it's under the control of the school.
Okay. Any other questions, Representative Scott? Representative Yarusso.
Okay.
Okay. Then, Representative Holberg.
If I might. Do you view that this bill will give school officials the right to ask to see content on a student's cell phone, laptop? So in other words, if there's an accusation that so-and-so was sending emails, do you believe that this bill will allow for a principal to call a student in and ask to see the contents of an electronic device that's not owned by the school?
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I believe the principals already do that.
Representative
Holberg. Does not change that.
Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair, you believe that they already do that?
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I think if I come forward and say that somebody is passing things around electronically and ask the school, as a student, and ask the school to investigate, I would imagine they would ask to see my cell phone, your cell phone, your laptop, my laptop, your iPod already.
Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair,
this proposal doesn't change that in any way.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that given the depth of the different kinds of bullying and when, I mean, you don't have any limitation on when it can occur, you know, your cyberbullying definition doesn't say that it has to be done during school, at school times, So, I mean, I'm curious, maybe one of our crack lawyers on the other side of the table might want to weigh in on whether or not...
they're all looking at her.
Representative Holbert, did you just call them crack lawyers?
Yeah, in a positive way.
Okay.
I can't believe that a minor could give consent for a search of a electronic device that they don't even own.
Anyone want to take the bait on that? Representative Urso.
Not a crack lawyer, but I've been in schools recently. There's nothing in this policy that affects what the school's general operating procedures are with regard to how they conduct investigations. It's not spelled out how they conduct investigations. Schools have policies about how they do that, and they have laws that they have to obey. There's nothing in the policy that affects what the school's policies are in terms of due process. Schools have policies about what their procedures are, and they have laws they have to obey, and there's nothing that takes that away. So a lot of these questions that are happening, coming up about, well, what is the, how do they do this, how do they do that, that will depend on how the district operates. And there's nothing in this policy that changes what happens when a district is investigating something. They have to investigate all kinds of things in a school. They investigate cheating. They investigate fights. They investigate thefts. They investigate graffiti in the bathroom stalls. And they have to have ways that they do that and ways that they do discipline and how they involve parents in that discipline and whatnot. And so this bill leaves it to the school to develop their policy, and I would presume that a school would develop it in such a way that would be consistent with the other policies they have in the building.
Mr. Chair, most schools already have a bullying policy in place as well. I know Anoka Hennepin does. I know private schools in my area do. They already have policies in place.
Okay, moving on to amendments. The A36 amendment, who claims parentage?
That would be me, Mr. Chair.
Representative Neuberger moves the A36 amendment. Representative Neuberger to the amendment. Can you speak to it?
Yes, Mr. Chair. If you look here, it's page 6. We'll just be inserting, as it's worded here, with a notice to the parent or guardian of the student, target or actor, or other affected student. This is simply fleshes out the notification process a little bit more, gives it a little more depth.
Okay, then, Representative Neuberger, I think your amendment should require an oral amendment on line 1.2, change the 5 to a 7, because this would refer to line 17 then, by your reference, and not line 15. Is that accurate?
That is accurate.
Okay, to the oral amendment, to the amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Mr. Chair, could I speak to the amendment?
We're not voting on the amendment yet.
Oh, we're sorry. Dabney, I was
voting on the oral modification to the amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Okay, now that it's corrected, Representative Dabney.
Sorry, my apologies, Mr. Chair. I would ask for a no vote on the amendment. Representative Neuberger himself illustrated why. It's a complicated world out there. We do have situations where parents have not behaved well in the past and are no longer allowed contact with the student. The school is legally prohibited from providing them information. The A36 amendment ties their hands and would require them to violate those court orders. I don't think we should go in that direction, and I think we should trust. I'm sorry, I'm going off on the wrong amendment, aren't I? No.
No, that's right.
Is this? On page 6.17? Yep. I'm sorry. Representative Neuberger, this is about providing information about community resources?
No, sir. This
Representative Neuberger.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
I got confused with the oral amendment.
It is. This
okay.
Is, this is a parent's right to know.
My apologies. Mm-hmm. Representative Neuberger, thank you for clarifying. Again, this would tie the hands of school personnel. They wouldn't be able to have a poster up on a bulletin board about community resources that are available because they would first have to solicit every student's in the school's parental permission for them to view such a poster. It would limit one of the another bill I'm carrying is school-linked mental health. They wouldn't be able to have a door over the mental health provider's office indicating that it was the local clinic that was providing access to mental health services, because they would first have to have every the permission of every student's parents in the school before they became aware of that. I don't think we should be afraid of information and providing simply providing information about community resources to children and families.
Representative Holbrook.
Well, Mr. Chair, that's not even what the amendment is. It says to with notice to the parent or guardian of the student target or actor or other affected student. I don't know why you'd have to have permission of everybody to do that. This is just, I mean, it's maybe, I mean, you make your point about you can't give information to every parent, but.
Mr. Chair, I'm digging myself in, and I apologize. I misunderstood the amendment. There still are situations about student safety, which I would hope would be the dominant concern of the committee, where if you are referring a student to an Al-Anon group, for instance, and you've got a family that's where one or more of the parents are actively alcoholic, they may not want their child going to that Al-Anon group and may not react well to the student. If it's, we've touched on issues of sexuality, if it's a referral to an agency that works with students around issues of sexuality, parents may not want the child receiving that information, let alone those services, and it may not create a safe situation for the student. So again, I'd like to leave this to local school personnel and their discretion. I trust them to know what's best given their community, the student, and the family.
Okay, thank you. All in favor of the A36 amendment as amended, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion does not prevail. Next amendment I have is
aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion does not prevail. Next amendment I have is the A37 amendment. Who claims authorship?
That would be me, Mr. Chair.
Representative Neuberger.
And I'm not a crack lawyer.
A heroin lawyer. Ah, here we are. Do your best, Representative.
I see. I'm attempting to. This just simply would delete at the school administrator's discretion on page 6, line 5. As we can read here, insert and then it continues on page 6, line 7. Delete the or, you would insert the school administrator's discretion notifying.
Delete the comma.
That's what we have.
So am I to understand that it removes any discretion? So there's required reporting then, Representative Neuberger, or there is no reporting?
There would be parents.
Thank you. Okay, any Representative Dabney?
Mr. Chair, you consider this to be germane to the scope of this committee?
I do.
Okay.
Mr.
Chair, let me just track the changes. So it's deleting the administrator's discretion about notifying the parents and the police, so requiring that all complaints be sent to the police for investigation. And then page 6, line 7, deleting the or and inserting, oh, I see, and the parent, so requiring it to the parents but leaving the discretion to the police. Mr. Chair, I'd ask for a no vote on this. This is an issue of student safety. Earlier drafts of the bill, Representative Neuberger, we actually did have a mandate on schools that the administrators that they had to notify parents. You illustrated well
in your earlier questions exactly why we can't do that and shouldn't do that. Also, keep in mind that all school personnel, licensed personnel, are mandated reporters. They may be aware of a situation, a home life for a student that isn't safe, and where notifying that parent that their child was involved on either end of a bullying situation may actually provoke an unsafe, potentially violent situation for the student. I want those mandated reporters not to be put in a situation of creating the very thing they then have to report and endangering student safety.
Representative Scott.
I just wanted to clarify the amendment, if I might. On page 6, line 7, we're deleting or and adding and then we're re-adding at the school administrator's discretion. I'm not sure that you understood that, Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, as I understand it, the administrator's discretion only applies to the notification of law enforcement and would no longer apply to the notification of parents. This would be a mandate then for them to, as Representative Neuberger explained earlier, to violate court orders.
Representative Scott.
And potentially endanger student safety.
I don't think that's the intent here with this amendment. I could be wrong, but it's... This has nothing to do with whether it's a parent or a guardian and if there's been, you know, court orders. I think what this is saying is that the parents need to know, period. I mean, the parent or the guardian, however you want to define it, the school administrator needs to contact the right authority that's over that child in a home setting. I would want to know, I'm guessing everybody around this table would want to know if their child was involved in something like this. Now, I understand not everybody's a good parent, but one of the parents needs to know, and you're usurping parental authority in this bill.
Mr. Gary, could you please
like a roll call.
Clarify what the amendment does?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, so this amendment basically moves the school administrator's discretion language to later in the section. So effectively, what the bill does currently is it says that at the school administrator's discretion, the administrator can notify parents of the targeted student, the parents of the actor engaged in the prohibited conduct, and law enforcement. So all of those notifications would be discretionary. With this A37 amendment, notification would be required of the parent of the reported target and the parent of the actor engaged in the conduct, and then the administrator could, at the administrator's discretion, also notify law enforcement. So it's discretionary for law enforcement, but not for parents, as the amendment is drafted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Representative Neuberger gave the best argument I've heard against this amendment in his earlier questioning.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Dabney. Representative Leaving.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, Representative Dabney, you know, not to pile on here, but I just had a situation with a constituent in my district who had a problem where her 6-year-old child was bullied by another 6-year-old child. And she wasn't informed for quite a while, and it was really quite a bad situation. In fact, it was kind of a sexual assault, if, you know, a 6-year-old sexually assaulting another 6-year-old. And it was quite disturbing to the parent because she wasn't told. So I'm wondering, and I think that actually might fall under the bullying, and it probably would fall under this bill, even though the conduct kind of even went beyond what this bill contemplates. But I just want to ask you if, wouldn't it, I think there's something to notifying the parent, but I think it may depend on the age of the child, or if it's a child with a disability who can't really communicate with the parent. And I wonder if there isn't a way to put in some kind of a... I get your argument. I understand there may be many situations where it wouldn't be in the child's best interest to have the school right away call the home, because many children don't have two parents, actually. But I do think there should be kind of a presumption that that would happen unless the school had a reason not to. In the case of my constituent, where it was a 6-year-old child, and the school did not tell the parent for a while, and the child then, actually this happened in two recent cases in my community, one where a child, an autistic child, was not verbal and couldn't communicate it to the parent, and the other with this 6-year-old who just went back into the situation where the parent didn't know. The school knew, but the parent didn't know.
Representative Horvin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, let me give you a counterpoint. I think the phrase at the school administrator's discretion is important there, because in my daughter's high school, there's a Muslim student who is gay and who was bullied because that student was gay. And the parents found out and beat the Muslim student within an inch of the student's life. And so I want the school administrator to have the discretion to decide whether to tell the parent and not to have to do it in every situation. And perhaps you could talk to Representative Dabney about elementary school students and that type of situation. But I think we have to, in some of the things we do, we have to trust the adults who run these schools and run these districts. And I know we don't trust them completely, and I know people want guardrails up, but I sure would rather have the language that Representative Dabney has in his bill, because I think it's more protective of students.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lieber.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I hear you, Representative Portman. I just think that we could, this needs to be finessed in some way, because both of these kinds of situations can happen. And I wonder if this could be worked on a bit and some language could be arrived at that, as I was suggesting, kind of creates a presumption, unless there would be a reason for the parents not to be notified. The reason could be such the kind of thing that Representative Portman just mentioned. It could be that the parents aren't, you know, that the conduct, the child is worried about the parent knowing or something. I don't know, but I just think that this should be worked on, because there are situations, I think, really most parents probably should be told. And the school, in situations, the two situations that I know of, very recent situations, it didn't happen.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney, I'd like to take a vote on this amendment.
Okay.
So, is there other comments from the committee? Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, you had talked a little bit about the possibility of restraining orders. I've dealt with them for the almost 30 years. I have yet to see where a restraining order has stopped a school from contacting a parent. If a school cannot contact a parent, then that child cannot be in that school. I've seen it where the parent is barred from the school grounds, but never where there's no contact, where they can discuss the child's issues. That's never happened. They've been able to keep them from the school grounds, but not that they cannot have contact. Also, part on this issue, if you're going to discipline my child, you better notify me. And that, I think that's what every parent wants it done. You might not want to notify the target's parent for issues, in case the issue that Representative Horton brought up, but if you're going to discipline my child, you better notify me, or that'll end up causing a lot of lawsuits.
Representative Debbie.
A couple of things. First of all, to Representative Liebling's concerns, I think if you go to the clause immediately before the one Representative Neuberger is attempting to amend here, including immediately intervening to protect the target of the prohibited conduct, I would hope that would give you some comfort that, in fact, if I'm the administrator and there's been an incident in the school, part of my acting to protect the target of the conduct would be notifying the parent so that they can support the child, guide the child, if, depending on what the situation is, seek out community resources, whether it's physical medicine, psychology, whatever it might be. So I think that starts us down the path that you're looking at of explicitly establishing an assumption that you would contact the parent. To Representative Johnson's concerns, because this is not the Education Committee, we haven't gone into, the thrust of this bill is not, in fact, about disciplining. It's about remedial approaches. It's about working with students to keep them inside the circle of the school community. Because what we know, particularly when you get to the high school level, is if you've suspended a student a couple of times, and of course, if they're suspended, you're going to find out, they're much less likely to graduate from high school. If we want schools where high academics are possible and where we're increasing the graduation rate, building positive, safe, and supportive school climates is a key
part of that.
Any other questions about the A37 amendment? I think a roll call has been requested. So CLA will take the roll.
Call what?
Sure.
Chairman Lesh?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ellen? Yes.
No.
You can use your help, Mr. Chair.
Way to provide direction.
He did. It was the psych of the evening. I changed my vote to nay.
Oh, yeah.
Representative Anderson.
That's good. Yes.
Representative Holstrom.
Yes.
Representative Holberg.
Yes.
Representative Portman.
No.
Representative Howe.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Liebling.
No.
Representative Neuberger.
I better vote yes. Yes.
Representative Carr.
No.
Representative Pugh. Representative Rosenthal.
No.
Representative Simon.
No.
Representative Scott.
Yes.
Representative Winkler. Representative Yaruso.
No.
Amendment fails 8-7. The A38 amendment. Who claims authorship?
38.
Civil immunity for the district if they make good faith effort to comply with new bullying laws.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to withdraw this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. The A38 amendment is withdrawn. Now, to your, I'm assuming this is yours, Representative Scott, the A39-1 amendment.
Yes, sir.
I still maintain this is not the the jurisdiction of this committee, that it falls squarely within the purview of education. However, to the amendment, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This would just delete the portion that applies this bill to non-public schools, and I think I've kind of already covered why I think that it shouldn't. Private schools, I know they're already very largely accountable to the parents, and if their child's being bullied, they leave, but larger than that, I think, is the constitutional issue here. So I'd encourage a red vote, and I'd like a roll call, please.
Roll call has been requested. Any other comments from members of the committee? Seeing none, roll call is Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, I'd ask for a no vote on the amendment. The bill is limited in its application to private schools to only those that accept public funds. As I stated previously, with public funds should come public accountability. Secondly, the state has a compelling interest in assuring the safety of all students across the state, not just some. And so I'd ask for a no vote on the amendment.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, would it be appropriate to ask staff if this appears to be constitutional? I mean, I think that's the kind of question on which a little expert opinion might be helpful.
Representative Liebling, no.
They're playing rock, paper, scissors.
They're crack lawyers, aren't they?
They're crack lawyers.
Mr. Chair.
I'm not going to. Representative Scott.
If you use that argument, Representative Dabney, if a private school gets $1 of public funds for, say, busing or for one school textbook, so that means we'd have to adopt everything else that's in statute. If your argument were to hold up, we'd have to adopt everything else that applies to the public schools, and it'd have to be applicable to the non-public schools. I mean, if that held up in a court of law, then we would be subject to everything, or it could be made subject to everything.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Representative Scott, you used busing as a specific. The very reason that we provide, that the public pays for and provides busing for private school students is based on a state Supreme Court decision about the safety of students. Compelling state interest about the safety of students.
Thank you. Roll call has been requested. The CLA will call the roll.
Chairman Lesh?
No.
Vice Chair Ellen?
No.
Representative Anderson?
Yes.
Representative Hellstrom?
No.
Representative Holbert?
Yes.
Representative Portman?
Nope.
Representative Howe?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Liebling?
No.
Representative Neuberger?
Yes.
Representative Paymar?
No.
Representative Pugh?
Yes.
Representative Rosenthal?
No.
Representative Simon?
No.
Representative Scott?
Yes.
Representative Winkler? Representative DeRusso?
No.
The amendment fails 6-9. Next amendment is the A40 amendment. Who claims authorship?
That's mine,
Mr. Representative Howe, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know, as long as we've talked that all we're doing is supplying summary data to the Climate Center. So in light of that, I still have some concerns about the verbiage, basically on page 18, line 28, in section 15. So what I'd like to do is delete qualitative, quantitative data gathering, interpretation, and dissemination of, and insert interpreting and disseminating, and then after summary data, insert obtained from schools. That way there's no doubt that all we're doing is gathering summary data and there won't be any names. Because I question when you look at qualitative and quantitative and all that, I think that there's a possibility of that personal data flowing through there. So I believe that all this does is make it specific. We know it's summary data. We know that's all that's being provided to the Climate Center, and that's why we provided it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howell, thank you. I share your concern. That's why we use the term summary data, which is codified in state law 13.02, subdivision 19. Let me read it for you to give you the same assurance that I have that we're arriving at the same point with the bill as currently drafted. Summary data means statistical records and reports derived from data on individuals, but in which individuals are not identified and from which neither their identities nor any other characteristic that could uniquely identify an individual is ascertainable. So the bill as written covers the concerns that you and I share. I'd ask for a no vote on the amendment.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, my concern is, you know, how do they know in a school how many Baptist students they have, how many Muslim students they have? And because that data comes from a specific school district, which is going to be included in that summary data, and it could come down to being one or two students, especially out in the rural area that I represent, there's probably only one Muslim student in a grade. And if that comes through in that summary data, they're identified. Whether you think they're identified, and the people at the school Climate Center aren't going to know that there's only one Muslim student in that classroom in that school district. So what I'm saying is, let's eliminate all that and let's get down to just that summary data that doesn't include that specific information. I think we need to go beyond what we think is going to be there and provide that data privacy, especially for our for those students.
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, could I ask the department to come down and help provide greater reassurance for Representative Howe on how they handle summary data and how state law applies?
Ms. Hermanson?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The department is very sensitive to any kind of data that is gathered that may specifically identify a student or a group of students, especially if the number is very small. As a practice and policy and all, on a report card, our accepted cell size is 20. And so as we gather any data about students that we report on the report card, and this is exemplified as specifically as report testing data and other data, we usually we always attempt to make sure that the cell size or the group of students involved is large enough so that we cannot in any way identify or label any specific student or smaller group of students, and that's been our standard practice for some time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I'm understanding, if I've got a school district and they only have one or two incidences of bullying in the school district, that's not going to be included at all in any of this data? That's not reportable data and not collected?
Mr. Chair, we're not going to be identifying them in a way that would identify a specific students. If, in essence, and this has been our practice for some time, if you are a small district and potentially that one incident is known, we would probably try to avoid reporting that data specifically because it would become known and the students involved would become known. As I mentioned earlier, we do all that we can to protect students in any particular identifying data that may label or identify a student. And so that has been our standard practice, and I think in this instance you may be accurate. And if it's a district of 200 kids and you've had one instance, we would try to protect that student and any identifying characteristic that would identify that student.
Representative Howe.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, my concern is I've got a school district that's fairly large, but the diversification of that school district is very minimal. How are you going to know? You know what the racial profile of every school district is?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't think we would be collecting the data in a way that would identify by a religious or that type of identification. It may be there was an incident of bullying that potentially was around this idea, but we're going to collect summary data where we very specifically and always try to eliminate any way and any data that we share or publish or whatever that we cannot in any way identify the student. That's been our standard practice, and it would continue in this instance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I thought this data was being collected so we could specifically target educational programs and preventative measures. And if we aren't getting specific to what's causing the problem, how can we get specific to what we're trying to prevent?
Ms. Hermanson.
Right. If I were to understand it, what you're referring to is how the school may use the data to improve their processes. Maybe I'm misunderstanding your statement.
Representative Howe.
I guess what I'm concerned, what I look at is the Climate Center is gathering this data to provide information back to the school districts to be able to formulate targeted informational educational programs to prevent this activity. If you're not identifying the targets and not identifying what's causing the problem, what good is the data?
Ms. Hermanson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, the schools are the ones who are going to first be using the information. The state as a whole are going to be collecting broader and more summative data to help us work with schools. And I guess I'm maybe missing your question, your point, but initially the schools use the information. the School Climate Center will collect broader summary data as a whole to help work with schools. But we do not in any way try to release or publish or use this data in a way, your concern was that we would identify specific students or smaller groups of students. That's not been our practice in any of the work we do.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if that's the case, then what's wrong with the amendment? Because that's exactly what I'm trying to do, is eliminate that data and get to a summary data that goes to the state and let the school keep the private data. And I don't understand where eliminating causes an issue in what you're doing.
Mr. Chair, I apologize. It's my understanding that is what the bill does, what you're stating.
Well, I thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess what I would like to do, I still believe that eliminating the quantitative, qualitative, gathered, all of that, I think if we get just and talk about the summary data, because that's what you're requesting, I think that's specific enough, and that's why I support the amendment.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions about the amendment? Otherwise, we will take a Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the reasons I object to the amendment is because it misunderstands the nature of data. I mean, specifying that it's qualitative and quantitative just tells us that your data should include both numbers and adjectives. And it doesn't say anything about reporting on specific students or anything like that. It just says that we need to consider both of those things.
All in favor of the A40 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion does not prevail. The A41 amendment, who's the author of this?
Oh, that's mine.
Excuse me. That is mine, Mr. Chair. I'm going to withdraw that amendment.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Withdraws the A41 amendment. The A42 amendment, rewriting the definition of bullying.
Also mine. I'd like to withdraw that.
Okay. Representative Scott withdraws it. The A43 amendment, eliminating requirement the districts.
I'd also like to withdraw that one.
Okay. Thank you. Then we have the bill as amended. Other comments from the committee? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I have to tell you, I'm really, really disappointed in the non-taking of some of these amendments that we offered, and the debate that basically said that the school knows better than the parents. I think that's wrong. I think you're going to run into some real constitutional problems with free speech and with freedom of religion in shoving this legislation down the throats of non-public schools. And I think that this bill really has less to do with bullying. I think it has everything to do with using the power of the state to control and shape attitudes and values of young children regarding the family structure and human sexuality. I think that's what this is about. And I would like a roll call on this vote, please.
Roll call has been requested. Other comments from members of the committee? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, I want to thank Representative Dabney for the hard work that he's done on this proposal. Members, I've previously carried some anti-bullying legislation, and I really believe that it is important that we say from the state perspective that this is unacceptable behavior and that we are going to do something about it. So thank you for your work, and I would encourage members to vote yes.
Thank you. Seeing no other comments from the committee. Oh, Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'd like to make the comment that we've heard over and over again that we'd like to have things at the discretion of the administrator. I tell you what, I'd like to leave this whole bullying thing at the discretion of the school district, the board, and the administrator.
CLA will take the roll.
Chairman Lesh.
Aye.
Vice Chair Allen.
Yes.
Representative Anderson.
No.
Representative Hillstrom.
Aye.
Representative Holberg.
No.
Representative Hortman.
No. I'm sorry. Yes.
Representative Howell.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Yes.
Representative Neuberger.
No.
Representative Tamar.
Aye.
Representative Pugh.
No.
Representative Rosenthal.
Yes.
Representative Simon.
Yes.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Winkler.
Yes.
Representative Yarusso.
Yes.
The motion prevails on a 10-7 vote. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
We're meeting again at 8:15. Thank you for your cooperation.
Thank you.
Committee's adjourned.